So tonight we have a really interesting discussion about depression, and I think this is really one of the foremost topics that we need to know as nurse practitioners. For example, today I would probably say that half of my patients I saw today were depressed, and yesterday as well, maybe more. So this is a big deal in today's society, and you'll find a lot of it, and some of them will make you very perplexed, and that's the idea tonight, is to help you discern some of that information. Tim Jennings is with us. He's a psychiatrist in Dalton. He's going to help me. I remember where all you've been in school. Come on up here. You're a real good friend, and I guess the way we met is I wanted you to speak for one of my health promoted classes in the religion building, and I was just so surprised when I called his office manager that he was so willing to talk, and since then I found out that he's very willing to talk. But at any rate, he is an AS nursing graduate right from here.
Yes.
Southern. And then
I got a bachelor's degree at the University of Tennessee, College of Chattanooga, and then I went to medical school at the University of Tennessee, Memphis, and I went on active duty with the Army, did residency in psychiatry at Eisenhower Army Medical Center, Fort Gordon, and Augusta, Georgia. And I finished with residency, and became the division psychiatrist.
Slow down.
Became the division psychiatrist for the 24th and 3rd Infantry Divisions for a couple of years, and then the chief of psychiatry at Army Hospital at Fort Stewart. Got out of the military in 97, went into private practice in Dalton.
So he bring her on because this is how fast he's going to talk to us.
No, I won't.
All right. So basically, I think what I find of value with Dr. Jennings is the fact that I know that his actual baseline is very spiritual, because as he went through school, he for every hour he spent in the humanistic theories of psychiatry, he spent 2 hours in his Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you'll see that coming through tonight. So that's what I really appreciate. So I'll give the time over to you. We really appreciate it. We can see that all of us are just waiting with a bated breath here. We just soak up information. And then we also have some faculty members here too. I appreciate them coming through.
Thank you. Thank you all for having me here this evening. And we are going to talk about the topic major depression tonight. And as an overview of what we're going to do, if I can get my computer to work and wake up, we're going to do a brief definition of depression, brief historic overview, then we're going to go into the epidemiology, diagnosis and course, pathophysiology of depression, what's actually happening in the brain when people are depressed, as well as looking at the mechanism of action of various antidepressant medications, the interventions that we make. Causes of depression, which I know this is a health prevention class, so we're going to spend some time on the causes and see what things you can do to try and intervene and prevent or resolve depression. And then we'll go into treatment options and strategies. So depression, what is it? It's a global dysfunction of the brain. It's a brain-based illness, one of many or a group of disorders with altered brain function. If you have a disorder with dysfunction of the nigrostriatal pathways in the dopamine system, well, we call that Parkinson's disease or Huntington's disease. If you have a disease in which people have lost neurons in the prefrontal cortex and altered acetylcholine signaling with amyloid proteins and neurofibrillary tangles, we call that Alzheimer's dementia. If you have a disease in which you have altered dopamine signaling to the prefrontal cortex or into the limbic system, we call that schizophrenia, or another form of altered dopamine signaling in another disorder, we call that attention deficit disorder. And if we have a disorder in which there's global dysfunction in the brain is not functioning, glucose metabolism is impaired, electrical activity is impaired, blood flow is impaired, protein production is altered, neurogenesis is altered, neurotransmission is altered, this is a disease we call major depression. So it's an entire dysfunction of how the brain is functioning. When we get into some of the details later, I'll give you some more insights into that. The Ebers papers in 1550 described major depression. So depression has been with us in the human species for quite some time. They described it in the Ebers papers as being due to demonic possession and being treated with incantations. In AD 150, the Greek physician Galen attributed depression, described depression, and attributed it to black bile. And we know how it was treated for more than a millennia with, anybody know?
Enemas.
Enemas maybe, but not as commonly. Leeches, bleeding, and blistering. They would put the glasses on them, put the candle outside the glass, heat the glass, pull blisters on people to pull out the black bile. and also the leeches and the bleeding. And then in 1000 AD, an herb started being used for various disorders called Ruwatha serpentina. And from Ruwatha serpentina, a drug was derived in 1952 called Reserpine. Has anybody heard of Reserpine? Reserpine is an antihypertensive drug, and it works by depleting the end plate terminals of their monoamines, dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin, thus lowering blood pressure. It was noted, however, that over 50% of the patients who went on Reserpine developed a psychiatric disorder. Anybody know? What are we talking about tonight?
Depression.
Major depression. Over 50% of the patients who went on Reserpine developed major depression. This triggered a whole lot of new thinking in people's minds. Wait a minute, prior to 1952, depression was attributed to how you were raised, having an unresolved edible conflict, psychodynamic factors. But now, in 1952, we have a drug that is causing over 50% of the patients who go on to develop depression. Maybe there's something organic, something physical going on, and a whole lot of research started going into looking at the various biological contributions, and research went into finding pharmacologic agents that could treat depression. Aretius in AD 150 said that the melancholic cases tend towards depression and anxiety only. If, however, respite from this condition of anxiety occurs, gaiety and hilarity in the majority of cases follows, and this finally ends in mania. This was almost 2,000 years ago, probably describing a bipolar patient about 2,000 years ago. Abraham Lincoln said, "I am now the most miserable man living. If what I feel were equally distributed to the whole human family, there would be not one cheerful face on earth. Whether I shall ever be better, I cannot tell. To remain as I am is impossible. I must die or be better to me, it appears." And Alexander Haig in 1900 said, in this condition, self-reliance is absolutely gone. Extreme modesty is common or even habitual. A featherweight will crush one to the dust, and even greatest good fortune will fail to cheer. So all descriptions of mood disorders. Epidemiology. If you are a woman, you have a lifetime risk of 10 to 25%. One out of four women in their lifetime will develop depression. If you're a man, that risk is lifetime prevalence 5 to 12%, about half that. Now this risk, just for being a woman, no other factors involved. If you have a medical illness on top of that, your risks go up. If you have a chronic pain condition, your risks go up. If you have a traumatic experience, your risks go up from the 1 in 4. Just being born a woman, you're going to have 1 in 4 risk of developing depression. 30% of the patients with general medical condition, 30% of patients with general medical condition have depression. And less than 50% of those seen in general medical practice settings have their mood disorders properly diagnosed and treated. So in a primary care office, less than half of those are treated and diagnosed properly. 20% of the elderly have depression, and 50% of hospitalized elderly have depression. Depression is common. You can look, and I'm not going to read all these on this list, but this is the list of some medical conditions and the comorbid depression that associates some of the medical conditions. The thing to note here would be coronary artery disease has the highest association with depression with all these medical disorders here. Postpartum blues, 50%, but that's not depression. 10% have depression in the postpartum period. And I guess we'll talk about some of the factors in the postpartum period when we get into some of the causes a little later. Depression is costly. Patients with depression will utilize the healthcare system and services at a higher rate. They have higher morbidity and mortality from their medical conditions. And I guess you've heard about the post-MI patients with depressions. Somebody has had an MI, and they have depression in the post-MI period. They have greater risk of recurrent occlusions and higher rates of death in the first 6 months after the MI than the patients with MIs and not depression. You all heard that. In fact, the data is so strong that depression in the post-MI period is a greater risk factor than elevated cholesterol and hypertension for recurrence and death. The reason for that seems to be, now this is really still fairly new information, a lot of primary practices don't recognize the importance of depression in the postpartum period, and a lot of patients in the post-MI period, and a lot of patients in the post-MI period aren't being treated for depression. One of the reasons, or two of the reasons why they hypothesize this is going on is when you're depressed, you have altered serotonin levels, which affect platelet coagulability, increasing risk of those clots and occlusions. And when you're depressed, the brain innervation through the vagus nerve to the heart is altered, and there's a much higher irritability of the cardiac muscle with higher arrhythmias in the post-MI period when you're depressed. And so they have more arrhythmias and heart stoppages because of their depression. So we want to treat our post-MI patients with depression. They have longer hospital courses when depressed. They're not as motivated to recover. Regardless, you can imagine the person with a severe depression who's had a fractured hip and had a hip replacement, and now you're trying to get them up and do their physical therapy where they're depressed. They're going to have a much more protracted outcome. Disability from major depression is greater than diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, hypertension, lung disease. Very severe disability from major depression. Depression is deadly. 15% of patients with depression will die by suicide. Not will attempt suicide, will actually die by suicide. But think about a condition where 15% of them die. It's a terminal condition. 15% will die. So we need to take depression very seriously. 70% of all suicides, those who actually commit suicide, 70% of them have depression at the time of suicide. And 70% of patients who commit suicide were in their primary care physician's office within 6 weeks prior to the suicide. And most of the time, they're not in the primary care office complaining of depression that first in those 6 weeks. They're in there with some other complaint, headache, stomach ache, not sleeping well, some other somatic complaint, typically. Occasionally, they will tell you they're depressed. Most of the time, they don't tell you they're depressed. But you look back on those who committed suicide, 7 out of 10 of them were in the primary care office within 6 weeks prior to suicide. So they're seeking and reaching out for help. And if we can be alert to that, and that's why a lot of primary care offices are putting out some type of screening instrument that will save the practitioner time, because I know with the insurance reimbursement issues today, you get about 6 minutes per patient. It doesn't really give you a great time to do a good psychiatric assessment on somebody. So a lot of people are using screening instruments like Hamilton depression scales, Lung depression scales, and so forth, that the patient will fill out prior to you seeing them, and you'll have that to look at. And if there's an indication of depression, then you can go and take a little more detailed history to determine if there's risks that need to be addressed. And if you guys have questions as we go along, you can stop and ask questions and raise your hand, and we're glad to entertain those as we go through. Diagnosis and course. Y'all familiar with the acronym SIGECAPS? SIGECAPS. It's a great acronym to remember, SIGECAPS. SIGECAPS. This helps you remember the symptom cluster for the diagnosis of major depression. If you write that down, we'll go through that. Any two-week history of 5 or more of the symptoms. How many symptoms? 5 or more of the symptoms, one of which must be the depressed mood or decreased interest in pleasurable activity. How many symptoms do you see in our slide here? There are 9. Where's the 9th? Depressed mood. Depressed mood is not in the acronym, but it is one of the symptoms. You don't have to have depressed mood. You have to have either depressed mood or a loss of interest or pleasure, which is in the acronym. So one or the other. So you actually have to have 5 out of 9 symptoms in order to meet the criteria for major depression. Sleep disturbance can be either hypersomnia or insomnia. The alteration in interest is also loss of pleasure and activity called anhedonia, loss of pleasure, loss of desire, loss of drive, loss of libido, loss of motivation, guilt or feelings of worthlessness, energy decrease, you don't get an energy increase with depression, concentration impairments, appetite can be increased or decreased with depression. Psychomotor activity can be increased or decreased. Some people with depression, actually you might think the classic person is de-energized, listless, apathetic, amotivated, sitting there with a blunt affect, not responding, and not moving. That's a classic depression. The patients can also have an agitated or anxious depression where they're depressed, where they're not sleeping, they have no motivation, they have no drive, they feel guilt-ridden, they have very little energy, but they have anxiety, which causes them to have increased psychomotor activity. Maybe they're tremulous, maybe they just can't sit still in their seat. And then, of course, recurrent suicidal thoughts or thoughts of death, ruminating about death. They might actually be thinking about killing themselves, but they might have lots of thoughts about death. Does everybody have those? Let's go through the course. Somebody has an episode of depression and is untreated. Now, this is kind of a graphic showing normal mood, and then somebody dips into depression, and then they're in remission or recovery. The normal course is anywhere from 6 to 24 months without intervention. Somebody has depression, and you do nothing, you let it run its course. Generally, what happens is somebody can stay in depression for anywhere from 6 months to 2 years before they spontaneously recover or show improvement out of that depression. If somebody shows improvement of 50%, 50% of the depressive symptoms have remitted or resolved. Anywhere between 50% and total remission is called a response. And the reason to recognize that is because when you're reading various studies on various agents and treatment, in order to get FDA approval for the treatment of depression, you have to show response. And so when it says 80% of the patients or 65% of the patients on this substance had a response to the medication, that means they had a 50% reduction in symptoms. They're still depressed. They're just less depressed. In order to have the depression gone, you have to reach remission, and it will use those words differently, response versus remission. So when you're reading your articles and journals, be sure and catch those words. Are we having a response, or are we talking remission? Because remission rates are much lower than response rates. Somebody with a severe Hamilton Depression Scale score of, say, 30, and you treat them with an intervention, and their scale now is 15, they've had a response. They would be positive. They would show somebody that would be a positive responder to a medication, yet they're still depressed because a score of 15 is still depressed. So that's what we're talking about. And then 100% recovery is called remission. If you have remitted your symptoms, you've treated, you've intervened, the symptoms have remitted, and they remain in remission for less than 12 months, and the person falls back into depression, that's called a relapse. If they have remitted for more than 12 months and they go back into depression, that's called recurrence. So it's just kind of some of the nomenclature. So somebody less than 12 months, they depress you, it's relapse. Recurrence, you've been in remission for 12 months or more. Dysthymia. Dysthymia is a mood disorder with depressed mood, which is a dysphoric mood, with symptoms of depression not severe enough to meet the diagnosis for depression. So they don't have 5, they might have 3, they might have 4, but the symptoms are severe enough that they interfere with functioning and they persist for 2 straight years or more without a significant period of time in those 2 years when the symptoms were gone. So a persistence of 2 years or more, dysphoric mood, altering function, without remission of symptoms. And the old double depression that really nobody ever talks about anymore, but if you read the literature, somebody, you read that phrase, double depression, that was somebody who had dysthymia, and then in the course of dysthymia, they developed a major depression on top of it. They used to call that double depression. Now, if you have somebody with depression and you intervene with an antidepressant medication, within 8 weeks, 67% of them will respond. What does respond mean?
50%
reduction in symptoms, right. Two out of three of them will have responded. One out of three will not have responded in 8 weeks on an antidepressant. What happens if we use a placebo? Placebo after 8 weeks, one out of three have responded. Two out of three have not responded. You're saying that's a lot of responders for a placebo. Yes? 33% response rate, that's a very high response rate. When we get into some of the physiology of what's going on in the brain, if you remind me, we'll talk about why that might be. People responding to a placebo. If somebody is in response, you've given an antidepressant, you've taken now that 67% group, that two-thirds that have responded, now we're dealing only with that group, they've responded, and we hit them with a placebo, take away the antidepressant, 50% of that group will continue their response, and 50% of them will relapse into depression. If you take that group that has responded and continue with their antidepressant, 90% continue their response, 10% relapse. Recurrence rate. Somebody's had one single episode of depression, and you treat them with an intervention, a medication, and their depression goes into remission, not response, remission, for 1 year, and then you stop their treatment, their recurrence rate is 10 to 15%. If you have somebody with two episodes of depression, you treat them for 1 year after their remission. So they're in remission, and you continue treatment for an entire year of remission, and you stop treatment, recurrence rate of 70%. If you have somebody with three or more episodes of depression, you treat them after remission for 1 year of remission, and you stop treatment, 90% recurrence rate. So this is why it's the general recommendation, if somebody's had three episodes for sure, lifetime treatment. In my particular practice, I'll treat them at least 5-6 years or more before I even talk about coming off if they've had three or more episodes. If they've had multiple episodes throughout their life, they never come off. If it's just their third episode, they're really advocating to come off, they'll have to spend time at least 5 years on medicine, remission, in total remission for the entire 5 years before I even talk about coming off of medicine. And you'll see why as we go along a little later, we get into the pathophysiology, what's going on in the brain. Two or more episodes, it's a coin toss. You've got the odds stacked against you. I would prefer, if it's their second episode, that they stay on medicine for a couple of years in remission before we talk about coming off medicine. Pathophysiology of depression. The PET scan on the left is a normal brain. The PET scan on the right is the brain of somebody who's depressed. Now, the bright lights is somebody whose brain is talking. Those neurons are firing. There's communication. There's exchange of information going on. Glucose is being metabolized. Everybody's awake, home, and having a good time. Over here, nobody's talking to anybody. There's no communication going on. There's no glucose being metabolized. Everybody's kind of just vegging. Nobody's doing anything. This brain is not firing and working like it should. You see the difference? Yeah, big time. So, what are your thoughts on what's happening in a brain during depression?
It just shuts down.
It just shuts down. Other thoughts?
Chemicals aren't working correctly.
Chemicals aren't working correctly. Chemical problem. Have y'all heard that, the chemical problem? We've got a chemical imbalance. Heard that? Yeah. Hopefully we'll have something better to tell after today. It's not a demon possession. I've actually still had people coming to my office wondering, do I have demons? Or is it a faith problem? I just don't have enough faith. Very common. This community has people still struggling with issues of depression. And it must be they don't have faith. If they had faith, they wouldn't have depression. Do you have people like that? Okay, what do you tell them? How do you handle that when somebody says, I don't, if I had faith, I wouldn't have depression?
Job had depression.
Okay, so some examples from the Bible, people had depression. What else do you say?
If you had faith, would you not have high blood pressure or diabetes?
Excellent. There you go. Well, yeah, but that's a physical illness. And you say?
So is depression.
That's exactly right. Depression is an illness of the brain. It's the most important organ of your body. You understand, every other organ system you have, its purpose is to serve the brain. Your lungs breathe to oxygenate the brain. Your heart beats to supply glucose and energy to the brain. Your digestive system works to bring nutrients to the brain. Every system you have serves the brain. Your arms and legs work to take you around to work for your brain. Okay? If you have a brain-dead person and the heart still beats, or the lungs still breathe, they breathe and beat without purpose. There's no purpose in a beating heart without a brain. Does that make sense to you all? Okay, this is the most important organ we have, and it's important that we take care of it. So I tell people, this is a physical organ, and just like every other physical organ, it can have something wrong with it. When Adam, we are 6,000 years at least from when God made Adam, and many genetic defects have entered our gene pool, and so too the brain can have defects, just like other physical parts of our body. And I asked them, do you expect to be as perfect as Adam? No. Do you expect your brain to be? No. Okay, then why can't something go wrong? And you lead them down the path, and they can answer the questions, and most of my patients get very comfortable with the idea of needing to take medicine. It's not evil humors. It's not moral depravity. It's not unresolved sin. Though unresolved sin can be a factor that we should talk about if you have a question about that as we go along. How can unresolved sin be a factor? Chemical imbalance theory, that's not necessarily the best way to express it. We'll see why that came along. Monoamine hypothesis, have you heard of the monoamine hypothesis? Okay. This is a depiction of neurons in the brain. In your brain, as an adult brain, you have approximately 100 billion neurons. A child, an infant, at birth, has 200 billion neurons. You have 100 billion neurons.
No.
Why?
Because
it's hard after all.
And by the way, there are 10 times as many supporting cells, glial cells and Schwann cells and so forth. 10 times, there's 1 trillion of those cells in the brain and 100 billion neurons in the brain. Why do you have less neurons in your brain than a baby that's born?
A lot more learning to do.
No, just what she said. Yes, it's kind of a sorting out process. This is exactly right. The way I conceptualize it anyway is imagine Michelangelo's block of marble before he starts to work on it. And after he starts to work on it, there's less and less marble, but then he ends up with a masterpiece, right? Your brain, you come into the world with a blank organ prepared to develop as the demand you place upon it. So as you place demands upon your brain, it will adapt and keep neurons that are being used and delete neurons that are not being used. So if you have a child and you lock them away from any other contact into a room for 5 years and no language is spoken to that child for 5 years, and then you start interacting with that child, speaking to that child, what happens? Do they ever get normal language? never get normal language, do they? Because they missed an opportunity for the neurons in the temporal lobe, which respond to language and learn language, they weren't being used, and so the brain says, oh, we don't need these. Delete, gone. Now, the child will learn language, but they will always have language impairments and deficits because those neurons that were needed were deleted. They've done experiments on cats where they would sew an eye shut on a cat. Leave that eye shut for a first year of life, and then open the eye, and guess what happened in the brain? The neurons that respond to this, the left eye, many of them were deleted, but a whole other group of them that weren't deleted were wired into the right eye. And the brain said, well, if they're not going to be used over there, we'll use them over here. And they got wired into the right eye to help the right eye see better. And then when they opened the left eye never could see because those neurons were already wired in over here or gone. The brain will adapt itself to the demands we place upon it. And as we get into some other things in just a minute, I'll show you why this is important in television watching and what television watching can do to a brain, especially in the child's brain. Now, what you see depicted here are the neuron cell bodies. The neuron cell bodies is where all the DNA is, where all your equipment or production machinery is to produce your neurotransmitters and proteins and all those things are all in the cell body. And then you have various little thread-like things leaving the cell body called either dendrites or axons. Dendrites bring information into the cell body. Axon takes information away. Now, the cell may have many, many, many dendrites. They have one axon leaving, but that axon can bifurcate in several places. And so even though it only has one axon leaving, that neuron can innervate several places at once, not just one place, because the axon can bifurcate. A neuron can have as many as 10,000 connections with other neurons. Now, this is just an actual microscopic of neurons in the hippocampus of the brain. And you can see all the connections and wires and all this kind of stuff inside spaghetti in there. 10,000 connections, 100 billion neurons. That means there's a potential for 40 quadrillion connections in your brain. That's a 4 with 16 zeros behind it. 40 quadrillion connections. Do you see how incredibly complex our brain is? It's amazing. This is a depiction of a synapse, presynaptic neuron, once we talk to postsynaptic neuron. The cell body of the presynaptic neuron has already produced and made neurotransmitter. Neurotransmitter comes down various microtubules in the axon to the end plate terminal where it is stored in vesicles. When a signal comes to depolarize that neuron, these are depicting the various vesicles with neurotransmitter. When the signal comes, then the vesicles bind to the end plate terminal, release their neurotransmitter into the synaptic space, signal or bind to postsynaptic receptors, which will cause a response in the postsynaptic cell or receptor. And it depends on what type of receptor we're hitting. There are different types of receptors that the neurons have. There are receptors called ion-gated channels, which medicines like benzodiazepines work on, and open various ion channels, either calcium channels or chloride channels, depending on the medicine you're using. And ions rush in, changing the polarity of your neurons. Does anybody remember the resting membrane potential of a neuron? Well, you say that's not important stuff, right? Neuron resting membrane potential is a minus 0.67 millivolts. Why is that important to know? Well, how do you think all your anti-epileptic drugs work? Can anybody think of an anti-epileptic drug? Depakote. Depakote works by, I'll just tell you real quick, we'll go on a little aside to tell you why this stuff's important to know. Depakote works by blocking sodium channels, blocking calcium channels, enhancing GABA, and blocking glutamate. Why is that important? Well, let's walk through it. Sodium is higher concentration outside the cell than inside the cell. Your neuron at rest is minus 0.67 millivolts. As it moves in a positive direction to minus 0.45 millivolts, that's its threshold for depolarization. When it hits that point, it will fire. Okay? The closer it rests to minus 0.45 millivolts, then the more irritable the neuron, the less stimulation it takes to get the neuron to fire. The further away, the more hyperpolarized, the more sedate and sleepy the neuron, the more stimulation it takes to get it to fire. You get something like Depakote. Depakote blocks sodium channels. Sodium's positive ion with one positive charge on it. High concentration outside the neuron, low concentration inside the neuron. If those channels are blocked, then those ions can't move in, can't move the neuron towards the depolarization threshold. Blocks calcium channels. Calcium has two positive ions on it. the positive charges on it. Higher concentration outside the neuron than inside the neuron, blocking that channel, prevents the neuron from moving towards the depolarization threshold. Glutamate is your central nervous system's primary excitatory amino acid neurotransmitter. It works on a receptor called the NMDA receptor, which covers another calcium channel. So by lowering glutamate, it shuts down another calcium channel, slowing again the neuron's ability to move towards the depolarization threshold, and it enhances GABA. GABA is your central nervous system's primary inhibitory neurotransmitter. Thank you. Primary inhibitory neurotransmitter. And by increasing GABA, it opens a chloride channel. Chloride has a negative charge, higher concentration outside than inside. Negative ions run inside the neuron. The neurons hyperpolarize and become sedate, sleepy. You know, those patients get on Depakote, they get sleepy and sedate because we're hyperpolarizing the electrical membrane potential of the neurons. And I wanted to walk through that because you're going to find that our medicines that work for depression don't work on ion channels. They don't work on this way of changing electrical potentials within the neurons. Okay, so we'll go to the monoamine hypothesis. The monoamine hypothesis, where did this hypothesis come from? Well, it came partly from the reserpine data that I already mentioned. And when you give somebody reserpine, it depletes these end plate terminals of their monoamines, the norepinephrine, dopamine, and serotonin. And when those are depleted, people get depressed. People get thinking, hey, our problem must be with monoamines. That must be our problem. This is a cartoon depiction of a presynaptic neuron, a postsynaptic neuron. Presynaptic neuron vesicle with neurotransmitter in it. This is your monoamine oxidase enzyme, which breaks down monoamines. That's why you see this guy here tearing up the monoamines, because it breaks them down and destroys them. This is your reuptake pump. You've heard of reuptake pumps, like serotonin reuptake pumps, okay? This is a reuptake pump on the neuron, so after it's released, this pump pumps it back in for repackaging and reuse. This would be postsynaptic receptors in your postsynaptic neuron, and this, of course, is your synaptic space. When a signal comes down from the presynaptic neuron to fire, then these vesicles bind to the end plate terminal. The neurotransmitter is released in the synaptic space, signaling the postsynaptic receptors. The reuptake pump starts sucking it back in, repackaging for use in more vesicles. Anything that's floating around in the cytoplasm, monoamine oxidase will destroy, so it doesn't float around indiscriminately in the cytoplasm. What has happened is that when you have decreased neurotransmitter here, this neuron isn't being signaled. It's not getting the stimulation it wants. It's not being talked to. It's being isolated. People don't like to be isolated. Neurons want to be active. We don't want to be left alone. And so what does the neuron do? It kicks out more receptors. Talk to me, somebody. I'm in the dark over here. Give me some stimulation. I don't like being in the dark. So the neuron kicks out more receptors. And this is what correlates with your depression. When people get depressed, they've had this upregulation in the postsynaptic receptors in the monoamine neurons. Now, this is not a cause of depression. This is a marker for depression. You see, what's causing the depression is the neuron is not being stimulated. If the neuron is not being stimulated, it's not getting the stimulation it needs to continue its activity with its various gene production, protein production, and it's starting to become sedate and not being used, okay? And what happens if neurons don't get used in the brain? They get deleted. The neuron doesn't want to be deleted. Stimulate me, somebody. Talk to me. So the neuron is throwing out lots of receptors out here so it can try and be stimulated with less and less neurotransmitter available. And so this is a marker. Somebody's getting depressed. This neuron is a depressed neuron because it needs all this extra stuff to be talked to. Now, what happens when we treat? This is giving a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. You have a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. Anybody name one? Monoamine oxidase inhibitor. Pharmacology 101. Parnate, Nardil. Okay, Parnate, Nardil. Okay, nobody uses them anymore. Nobody uses them because they're very dangerous. And they're dangerous because they actually permanently destroy until more monoamine oxidase is made by the neuron, the monoamine oxidase. And without monoamine oxidase, then the various neurotransmitters build up. And as they build up, because they're not being destroyed, then you have more postsynaptic release of monoamine, which means you get more stimulation and you get the downregulation of the postsynaptic receptors, which correlates with clinical improvement. They're getting better because the neuron is being more active now. It's getting the stimulation it needs, and it doesn't need all the receptors, so it takes them away. Now, this is depicting a reuptake pump inhibitor. Anybody think of a drug that blocks reuptake pumps? SSRIs is a class of drugs. What's the name of the drug? Paxil, Prozac, Zoloft. Well, butrin is a reuptake pump blocker. What reuptake pump does it block? Does it block serotonin? No. Dopamine and norepinephrine blocks those reuptake pumps. It's doing the same function. It's just that it's working on a different type of neuron. If we're on a serotonin neuron, then the drug that would block this would be the ones you described in Lexapro, as well as some of the SNRIs. SNRIs are serotonin norepinephrine reuptake pump inhibitors, which block both. Drugs, can anybody think of an SNRI? Effexor, that's right. And the tricyclic antidepressants. Tricyclic antidepressants are SNRIs. They block the serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake pumps. That's what they do. They're just the older drugs. And Cymbalta. Cymbalta blocks the serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake pumps. So you're blocking pumps, increasing serotonin signaling in the serotonin neurons and in the norepinephrine neurons. And when you go to effector, very high doses of over 450 milligrams, you also get some dopamine reuptake inhibition. And so when we block reuptake pump, even though there's less neurotransmitter being released, since we're not taking it back up, it leaves more neurotransmitter in the synaptic space, stimulating over here, so you get that downregulation of the postsynaptic receptors neuron as the postsynaptic neurons functioning again and feeling better again. So this is basically how the two major classes of medicines work, the monoamine oxidase inhibitors, the tricyclic antidepressants, and the reuptake pump blockers, SSRIs, SNRIs. And there's one other novel drug out there, which is depicted here. And I will describe it for you, see if anybody can tell me what this drug is. Now, what they're depicting here is getting a little complex, so don't get too stressed out on the complexity. Just kind of be in awe of how incredible we're made. But I'll walk through the complexity with you. This is the serotonin circuit, serotonin neuron. This would be the cell body. This would be the dendrites coming into the cell body. This would be your axon going out over here. This would be a norepinephrine neuron, cell body, dendrites coming in, axons going out, some of those bifurcations, the axons going out, going this axon and the cell going out here. Norepinephrine neurons modulate serotonin neurons. They have the ability, and by the way, serotonin neurons can modulate norepinephrine neurons too, go either way. But what we see here, anybody remember your alpha-1, alpha-2 receptors? Alpha-1, alpha-2 receptors respond to which neurotransmitter? Which neurotransmitters stimulate the alpha-1 and alpha-2 receptors? What drugs do you use in primary care that work on the alpha-2 receptor? To lower blood pressure, and if you stop it suddenly, they'll have a hypertonic crisis. If you stop this one suddenly, they'll have a hypertensive crisis. Yes, what I hear? Catepress. Catepress, clonidine. That's exactly right. Clonidine works on the alpha-2 receptor. Okay, and let's just walk through what this drug is doing. You'll notice that when norepinephrine stimulates the alpha-1 receptor, this is the accelerator on the serotonin neuron, telling that serotonin neuron to start fire, release more serotonin. When norepinephrine stimulates the alpha-2 receptor, that's the brake. Hey, you've got enough, shut down, no more serotonin, turn yourself off. So we've got an accelerator and we've got a brake. Alpha-1 is your accelerator, alpha-2 is your brake. Okay? Also, the norepinephrine neuron itself has, and all neurons have, what's called autoreceptors. Presynaptic neuron wants to talk to postsynaptic neuron. Presynaptic neuron releases a neurotransmitter in the synaptic space, stimulates the postsynaptic neuron, and on the neuron that released, there's a receptor that is signaled by that neurotransmitter that says, okay, you've got enough after, concentrations are high enough, you can stop, you don't need to release anymore. It's called an autoreceptor. It says, we're good enough, you're good. On the serotonin neurons, it's a 5-HT1D receptor. But on the norepinephrine neurons, it is an alpha-2 receptor. This particular drug we're talking about blocks alpha-2 receptors. So it blocks the alpha-2 receptors wherever they are. They happen to be on the norepinephrine neurons, which is the brake on the norepinephrine neurons. So if you block the brake, it's like cutting the brake cables, it disinhibits releasing more norepinephrine. Well, releasing more norepinephrine is going to stimulate the alpha-2 receptor, which is your accelerator, right? So it's going to step on the accelerator of your serotonin, releasing more serotonin, while at the same time it blocks the brake on the serotonin neuron too. So you get lots of serotonin release when you use this drug. Anybody know what it is? Remeron. This is how Remeron works. Remeron is different from all the rest. And so you can get a synergistic effect if you have really recalcitrant depressions and you really want to help increase monoamines in the synaptic cleft. Imagine if we use a drug that steps on the accelerator, blocks the brake, and then we add a reuptake pump blocker in there. You see? You can get synergistic effects going on. And I'll just tell you while we're here, since we're talking about Remeron briefly, a little nugget to put in your back pocket. Remeron is a very potent 5-HT3 antagonist, which is the same mechanism as Zofran. Has anybody heard of Zofran? What does Zofran do? Remeron does everything Zofran does for 1/10 the cost. Okay, blocks it in the gut wall. But Remerdin is also a 5-HTC antagonist in the hypothalamus, which is your satiety center. It blocks satiety. So Remerdin is much more potent anti-nausea drug than Zofran. Did y'all know that? Way more. Try it sometime. I've had patients with brain metastatic breast cancer to the brain that were in the hospital with IV Phenergan, IV Zofran, nausea, vomiting constantly. Put them on 30 milligrams of Remerdin the next day they're eating breakfast. Okay, Remerdin is a potent anti-nausea drug. Of course, the side effect of that is people go on Remerdin are hungry. They want to eat all the time because it stops nausea and blocks satiety. So, you know, if you have those sick, elderly, medically complicated patients with lots of nausea, and you need, and they're depressed, Remerdin's a golden drug. It also promotes sleep because it has antihistamine side effects as well, so they sleep very soundly. Okay. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but we've got a little problem here. See, when we give an antidepressant, we will cause, this is the synaptic availability of neurotransmitters, very low, we're depressed. We give a drug, suddenly, we get a very quick rise in synaptic neurotransmission. But clinical effect lags behind. We've got synapses improving within minutes. You all notice that. I don't know if you knew that. If you give an antidepressant like Prozac or Zoloft or any of them, within minutes you're going to block those reuptake pumps. Synaptic levels of the serotonin, fusing serotonin inhibitor, will rise within minutes. But patients don't get better for days or weeks, and the receptor sensitivity doesn't drop for weeks. Why? Have you noticed in psychiatry we have drugs that work in two general ways? We have those drugs you give and within minutes. I mean, within minutes, patients show clinical improvement. But you have other drugs you give and patients don't show improvement for days or weeks. Have you all noticed that?
2 weeks.
Pardon?
Usually 2 weeks.
Yeah, 2 weeks or more. What's going on? Well, drugs that work within minutes are medicines like your benzodiazepines. Give a benzodiazepine, Ativan, Xanax, Clonopin, Valium. It hits a GABA receptor, which opens a 37 here once. Chloride channel, okay? Chloride channel. It's a chloride channel. Chloride ions rush inside the neurons hyperpolarize, and the patient goes, they get that immediate clinical response. But if you give an antidepressant or antipsychotic, patients don't get better for days or weeks. Why? Because we're no longer working on ion channels, we're working on transmembrane receptors. This would depict transmembrane receptors, say a serotonin receptor, 5-HT1A receptor, which is your target receptor in the treatment of depression. This would be your neuronal membrane. This is a ligand binding to the receptor such as serotonin or an antidepressant, but typically serotonin, not an antidepressant, but serotonin, binding to its ligand, to its transmembrane receptor. When that happens, it causes a configuration change inside the neuron. When that configuration change happens inside the neuron, it causes a binding of a G protein inside the neuron. And that G protein binds, it activates a protein kinase, which then activates a second messenger, such as the phosphatase. That second messenger will make its way through the inside of your neuron. This would represent a Golgi apparatus, on its way over to the nucleus of your neuron, where your DNA is. Pardon? Yeah. When it gets to where your DNA is, the second messenger does various things in the nucleus where your DNA is, but it ultimately results in gene expression change with protein production change inside the neuron. This is why it takes days or weeks to see clinical improvement with antipsychotics or antidepressants. It's working on this cascade of events to cause gene expression to change. Now, if you conceptualize this as a series of dominoes, the first domino you kick over is the various transmitter binding in there, binding of that transmembrane receptor. That's your first domino. Then all those things inside the cell that you don't need to remember because she won't quiz you on it. The last domino to fall is the gene expression change in protein production in patients getting well. You only have to kick this thing over. You have to kick this thing over every day to keep this process going, because if you stop kicking it over, you stop the stimulation for the gene expression change to keep going. So you have to take your medicines regularly. You have to keep this thing going. Okay. Now we know some of the...
Let me just stop right there. But what often happens is they feel good at 2 or 3 months, and then they stop.
Yes. And what happens? Why?
Because you haven't continued that process.
I'm going to show you why in just 2 more slides. Okay. So, some of the genes we've identified, have you heard of a gene called brain-derived neurotrophic factor? BDNF. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor. This is like fertilizer for your neurons. When your brain makes this protein, oh, your neurons love this stuff. They grow, they branch out, they connect, they learn faster and easier, and your brain makes new neurons under the influence of this protein. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. When this protein is turned off, your brain stops making new neurons. The neurons you have begin to wither and die, and you begin losing neurons. That's not good. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor is one of the genes that's been identified in the treatment of depression or involved in depression. And you see this cascade of events now. High unremitting stress state, high unremitting stress hormones and cortisol and all these other things turn off brain-derived neurotrophic factor. When brain-derived neurotrophic factor gets turned off, neurons begin to die in the hippocampal regions of the brain. Now, I don't know if you've known too much with the imaging studies, but people with depression, the imaging studies show their hippocampal volumes are shrinking. They're shrinking because their neurons are dying in the hippocampus. And I'm going to show you about the hippocampus in just a minute. As you treat the patient and they start showing clinical improvement, hippocampal volumes start increasing again. Why? Because brain-derived neurotrophic factor is available again, and the neurons are being reproduced in the hippocampal regions again. Well, isn't that good? That's a good thing. Does anybody remember being taught, we have all the neurons, we're ever going to have, you lose them, they're gone. They don't get any neurons. Was I the only one taught that? Okay. Well, we know that's not true. The brain actually makes new neurons now. Let me ask you this question. What substrate does the brain use to make a new neuron? What physical material does a new neuron get made out of? You know, every place in the body, most places in the body, things happen by mitosis, right? The cell splits into another cell. Can a neuron with 10,000 connections disconnect those 10,000 connections, split, and then go back into the 10,000? Can't do that. So where's the substrate coming from for a new neuron? Cholesterol, fats, a good guess, but no. Good guess, no. Pardon? No, that's the energy we need to do a lot of important things in our body. Bone marrow stem cells. Stem cells. The life is in the blood, right? Yeah, the life is in the blood. Bone marrow stem cells, under the influence of these proteins, will differentiate into neurons. Now, hopefully there's somebody in the room thinking, have you ever heard of a procedure called a bone marrow transplant?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, and once somebody has a bone marrow transplant, whose bone marrow do they have? Theirs or somebody else's?
Yes.
And whose bone marrow stem cells do they have? What do you think is going to happen? What? They've actually done autopsies of people now, and we've had bone marrow transplants. And a woman whose XX chromosomal pattern has had a bone marrow transplant from a man, XY chromosomal pattern, they found neurons in the brain with XY chromosomes. Absolutely. Done. Done deal. So you got to ask the question.
Does
nobody knows.
Start thinking like a man.
She goes, you're going to start liking football? You don't want to shop anymore? Oh, no. Yes, nobody knows, honestly, the long-term implications of what that could mean for one's development, neural development, personality development, those things. What happens if somebody as a child has a bone marrow transplant, and then through the course of their life, they have neurons from the donor throughout their life? Does that have any potential implications? Well, it very well may, because we know that the protein produced in the neurons actually influence the effect of the growth and development of the brain. So depending on the new donor DNA and what they're going to get, who knows? That research is just all speculative at this point. Okay, what am I showing you here? Do you remember your DNA? It lives in the chromosomes in the neuron, and the chromosomes are packed in by chromatin, so the DNA goes into chromatin, then into chromosomes. In order for DNA to produce protein, what has to happen is the DNA has to unravel, and DNA is raveled around histones, and then packed into chromatin, then packed into chromosome. And the DNA, after it comes off the histone, is in a double helix. Remember the double helix of DNA? And then for protein to be produced, that double helix has to unzip. And then your translation RNA comes in, and your transcription RNA and your messenger RNA goes out to the ribosomes, and you have your proteins produced. But what happens if the DNA doesn't unzip? Can't make proteins. That's exactly right. Well, they've done some interesting studies on animals where they have stressed them and developed the animal version of depression, which is the apathetic, listless, unresponsive animal that just sits in the corner and won't do anything anymore. And one thing, this is mice, so don't feel too bad, okay? Or rats, okay? It's not your cute little kitty. Okay? And what they do, once they get them into a stressed state where they're in this depressed, they call it chronic defeat, the equivalent to a depression, they've taken and looked at what's going on in their neurons, what's going on in the gene expression. And what they found is, this is normal brain, this is normal DNA wrapped around histones with an occasional methyl group attached to the histone, but the DNA can unzip and messenger RNA can be produced. Chronic defeat or the depressed one, you see all these methyl groups attached to the histones. These methyl groups come in and actually lock up the DNA, so the DNA can no longer unwind or unzip so that the proteins can't be produced anymore. Then when you give an antidepressant, in this particular study it was imipramine, a tricyclic antidepressant, What happened is, after that cascade of events that I described with those transmembrane receptors, is that acetyl groups were attached to the histone where the methyl groups were. They did not knock the methyl groups off, but they neutralized the methyl group's ability to lock up the DNA, so the DNA can now unzip again and these proteins can be produced again. Isn't this cool? That's cool stuff. Well, what's important to know about this? Anybody remember your organic chemistry? Yes, I see some heads nodding. Good. Methyl groups have stronger chemical bonds than acetyl groups. Acetyl groups have weaker chemical bonds. So if they have weaker chemical bonds, they're going to stay on longer or stay on shorter?
Shorter.
Shorter. So here we have somebody with depression. We give an antidepressant. Antidepressant over several weeks causes the acetyl groups through that cascade of events we talked about to attach to the histones. The histones begin unraveling. The DNA begins unraveling again. Protein begins to produce. Neurons start being produced in the hippocampal regions. Patients perk up. They're not depressed anymore. And they go, wow, I feel great. Don't need this anymore. Stop taking their antidepressants. Stop taking their antidepressants. They do good for a couple days, maybe even a week or two. But what's happening is the acetyl groups start detaching from the DNA. The methyl groups have stronger chemical bonds. They stay attached. The acetyl groups detach, and the DNA gets locked up again. The protein starts being produced again, and the patient gets depressed again. And then you hand them more antidepressant, go through the same process of rebuilding and rebooting all this process. Does this make sense to everybody? This is really the best understanding we have of this process. And this is not the exclusive thing that happens in depression. This is one of the things that's happening in depression, but it's not the only thing that's happening in depression.
Okay, so what do you tell a patient? I mean, you don't go through all this stuff.
It depends on how hard-headed they are. Mm-hmm. I actually pull up sometimes, because I use electronic clinical records, and I have this stuff at my fingertips, and I've had occasional patients who actually pull this stuff up and show this to them. Mm-hmm. And then that just pretty much sews it up.
Yeah, really, it's really a sales job.
It is.
To get them on that.
Yeah.
And to keep them on there.
Yeah, there are some of those patients who really have a hard time, but when you show them all this and they see the mechanisms behind it and they see that this is really a physical process going on, then they are much more willing to take medicine. Without it, so this whole idea of chemical imbalance, you know, you just don't have enough chemicals. Or, you know, I've had patients come tell me, first time I'm assessing long history of bipolar disorder, something coming from another practitioner, and they say, I said, you know, what's going on with you? And the first thing out of their mouth is, well, you know, I have low levels of lithium in my blood. Do you understand that we're not supposed to have any levels of lithium in our blood? Okay? I've got low lithium levels. That's my problem. Okay? Somebody told them that they had too low lithium. This is their sales job. And that they need to take lithium in order to be normal. And they believe in this whole thing. You're going like, no, we don't need to create stupid things for our patients to take their medicine, do we? No. No, we can give them real scientific evidence as to why they need to take their medicine. That's not because they're lithium deficient. So, did that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, this is our first hour. Let's see. Oh, this is just to show you the limbic system. This would be your limbic system here. This is your hippocampus. This is your amygdala. Anybody heard of the amygdala? Let me show you. So this is another way to depict it. This is your hippocampus. Hippocampus is where you have your memories formed. This is all really important in learning. And amygdala is where you get your sense of anxiety or fear. Okay, anxiety disorders, amygdala, stimulating the locus coeruleus in the brainstem to fire off all the norepinephrine secreting neurons that cause all the hyperventilation and the heart racing and the tremulousness and the sweating and all those different things. But it's coming from the amygdala. Now, if you notice something here, every sensory system in the brain, in order to talk to the cortex, and you don't know that there's a problem until the cortex has been told. Okay? So you aren't aware of anything going on with your body unless it gets to the cortex. So if somebody is, there's a little ant chewing on your leg, okay, you won't know it until it comes to the cortex. That's why if they give you a local anesthesia, block a digit, and you're numb, somebody could be chewing off on down here, you won't know a thing because the cortex has not been told. In order to get to the cortex, all sensory systems have to go through the way station of the brain called the thalamus. That's the way station. Nobody talks to the cortex before going to the thalamus, which is deep in the center of the brain, except olfaction, smell. Smell can talk to the brain directly. And if you notice how this is wired here, olfactory system can talk to the brain and it goes straight into the hypothalamus. Anybody know what the hypothalamus is? Hypothalamus has your... Pardon? involved in eating, involved in sleep regulation, involved in hormone regulation. It talks to the pituitary with the various corticotropin-releasing factors, and the pituitary has corticotropin-releasing hormone, okay? So all that in the hypothalamus, you can smell, and this is why scents can have such powerful influences, why women who room together, cycle together, okay? Because all the olfaction bringing those pheromones going into the hypothalamus, causing this hormonal cycle, the changing, okay, right into the, right there. And also look how it wires straight into the amygdala. Why is it wiring into the amygdala like that? That's because it gets straight wired because you have to have a quick alert when you're going to put a bite of food in your mouth. The nose is right here to alert you quickly, hey, this is rotten food, don't eat this stuff, okay? And you get a quick alert, stop, don't eat, okay? So that's why it's wired straight in. Now, if you're walking along through the woods and you see, this is kind of just to kind of give you how the brain works a little bit. You're walking along through the woods and you see a snake over there. What happens is your occipital lobes, where your vision is, quickly fires off to the amygdala that there's a snake over there. That actually the occipital lobes compare what that visual object is to restored memories of other objects that are similar, identifying it as a snake and firing off over to the amygdala, which immediately fires off to the locus coeruleus and the brainstem and the motor centers to fire off your autonomic nervous system. So your heart starts pumping, you start breathing, then you start moving, and then your cortex wakes up and goes, oh, there's a snake! But all that's already happened before it gets to your cortex. Your cortex gets last, and then you go, oh, okay, it's just a rubber snake. And your cortex sends back to the amygdala, rubber snake, I'm okay. Yeah, and that's kind of how it works. Alrighty, prefrontal cortex, we're almost done. Prefrontal cortex and depression, almost done with this section. I'm going to take a break and go on. Alright, prefrontal cortex, we've discovered patients with depression. Not only do they lose neurons in the hippocampal region, but prefrontal cortex, they have small neurons in the prefrontal cortex that don't function as well, and they have less supporting cells when they're depressed than patients without depression. So they also have the prefrontal cortex changes that are occurring in the brain. One other thing about the limbic system is where you get your pleasure. Limbic system is also the part of the brain that attaches salience or relevance. Why is that important? Salience or relevance. If you stop and listen, y'all hear fan blowing? That's been blowing the whole time. How many of you paid attention to just now? It was there, but your brain said insignificant, irrelevant, ignore it. People with schizophrenia have a broken limbic system, and so they will attach salience or relevance to things that are irrelevant. And so they'll hear that noise and they'll go, somebody's over there trying to poison us. Because they have this sense of that's important, pay attention. Now, if right now you started smelling smoke, and I'm not talking cigarette smoke, but like building on fire smoke, say we're sitting here talking, you smell that smoke. Immediately, your brain attaches significance, and you go, whoa, pay attention to that, don't ignore that. That's the limbic system attaching that emotional significance. And so when you feel that in your own experience, when something has that sense of significance, you can't really ignore it, can you? No. That's why schizophrenia is a difficult disease. That's why they end up with all these delusions, because they have that sense of significance on insignificant things, and it's very hard to ignore that sense. Okay, we'll take a break, and I'll do a little bit more of the neurophysiology, and then we'll go into various causes of depression and options we can take to intervene and help, and then we'll go to treatment option strategies and give you an option. But let's take a break. Okay, this is a depiction of the dopamine circuitry in the brain. I'm going to just walk you through a little bit of the dopamine circuitry and why this is important. There are four primary dopamine pathways in the brain. The nigrostriatal pathway, this is the pathway that's functional in Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's disease is a neurodegenerative disease. You lose neurons in this pathway, if you lose neurons in this pathway, then you lose dopamine signaling, you get Parkinson's movement problems. You have rigidity, you have tremulousness, you have loss of affect and expression. If we block dopamine in this pathway with drugs, we can cause this problem. What kind of drugs do that? Antipsychotics. Give somebody an antipsychotic, you shut down dopamine signaling here and you can cause serious movement disorders.
Geodon
is one, or Haldol would be much more easier to deal with. You can also get this with Reglan. Reglan will cause movement disorders. You need to watch that. If you have somebody developing tardive, I've got a patient in my office all the day, he's got terrible tardive dyskinesia. If you know what tardive dyskinesia is?
That muscle
twitching.
Mm-hmm. Tongue's going like this constantly from Reglan.
Okay. So you get movement disorders from things like, right, people think it's an innocent drug. And then, as my office manager wife knows, serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Serotonin reuptake inhibitors, through a modulation of dopamine, increasing serotonin reuptake inhibitors, as you increase serotonin, it turns off dopamine signaling. Dopamine signaling drops. And so you'll notice patients with serotonin reuptake inhibitors, a certain percentage of them have akesthesia or restless leg syndrome because they're decreasing dopamine in the striatal regions. So you watch your patients if they're on a serotonin reuptake inhibitor and they complain of restless leg as a new symptom, then it's probably not primary restless leg, it's probably a side effect of your serotonin reuptake inhibitor. You can also have problems, we'll just walk through. This is the different inhibitor pathway. This is your pituitary gland, block dopamine here, spike prolactins. Simulate dopamine here, shut down prolactin stimulation, so you give bromocriptine to patients in a postpartum period, shut off breast milk, because you're stimulating dopamine from bromocriptine. Then you have the mesocortical. This is your prefrontal cortex right behind your forehead. You do your reasoning, your thinking, your imagination, your creativity, your motivation, your drive, all those different things. Shut dopamine down here. You become apathetic, listless, amotivated, have cognitive problems, and or attention motivational problems. And that's why kids with attention deficit disorder have problems. You give them stimulants, you want to increase dopamine in the prefrontal cortex so they can attend, focus, concentrate, and so forth better. If you give a serotonin reuptake inhibitor to a kid with attention deficit disorder, which is commonly done, worsen their attention deficit symptoms because you can decrease dopamine into the prefrontal cortex. Where you can see this most commonly is patients with depression that usually use the serotonin reuptake inhibitor. A certain percentage of them will come back. Remember, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, Zoloft, Prozac, Lexapro, Paxil. You put them on one, they'll come back a few months later and say, you know, doc, the crying spells have stopped. Sadness and depression is gone. I don't feel suicidal anymore. But I don't feel much of anything. My drive, my libido, my creativity, I just feel blah. What they're telling you is, you have shut the dopamine off to the prefrontal cortex by the serotonin reuptake inhibitor. You've got to get dopamine flowing back into the prefrontal cortex in order to get those symptoms to go away. You have several treatment strategies you can use. One, you can drop the serotonin reuptake inhibitor down and then add in something like a reuptake pump blocker like Wellbutrin. And if you do that, then and it works for them, you'll have dopamine coming back into the prefrontal cortex. If you just add in Wellbutrin, or if you take treating a kid with attention deficit disorder and use Strattera, has anybody heard of Strattera? What does Strattera do? So if you have a kid with attention deficit and you put them in a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, you can worsen their attention deficit symptoms, but you will overcome that with a stimulant like Adderall or Ritalin, because stimulants force the N-plate terminals to release dopamine.
How long does it take the Adderall and the Ritalin to work?
Same day, if it's dosed properly.
Oh, really?
Same day, if it's dosed properly. Yes. But if you give Strattera, Strattera is a reuptake pump blocker. Now think this through with me. Presynaptic neuron wants to talk to postsynaptic neuron. So presynaptic neuron releases neurotransmitter into the synaptic space, right? Stimulating postsynaptic receptors. And then it has reuptake pumps that suck that back up. Okay? You give a reuptake pump blocker to block the reuptake pump, it keeps the neurotransmitter out there signaling longer, right? Now, if you give a reuptake pump blocker to a neuron that doesn't have, is not releasing any neurotransmitter, won't make any clinical difference. No neurotransmitters being released out here, and you block the reuptake pump, does it give you any clinical benefit? No. When you give a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, it's shutting down dopamine release. When you give Strattera to block its reuptake, you've reduced release, but you're undermining the impact of Strattera when you get those two together. Same thing's happening with Wellbutrin in a depressed patient. If you just throw Wellbutrin on a patient who has all this apathy that we're talking about, and they have a high serotonin reuptake inhibitor gone, it doesn't really help because the dopamine neurons aren't releasing. You're shutting off release. So you've got to drop serotonin reuptake inhibitor down so they start releasing again, and then adding in the reuptake pump blocker can be beneficial. That's one strategy. There's another strategy you can use, and that is the serotonin receptor on the dopamine neurons that is being stimulated that's turning them off. You can block that receptor, that's a 5-HT2A receptor. An antidepressant that blocks that receptor is Remeron. Remeron blocks that receptor. So if you add Remeron on, it will block the inhibition from the serotonin neurons, causing disinhibition or cutting the brake cables of the dopamine neurons, releasing more dopamine in the prefrontal cortex and other pathways. So Remeron can be added in. This is the strategy we use. And the atypical antipsychotics, primarily Seroquel. Seroquel is the best at doing this. So Seroquel at bedtime, if you've ever seen psychiatrists, have a patient who's depressed, who's not bipolar and not psychotic and not schizophrenic, and they come back and they're on Seroquel at bedtime with their antidepressant, and you're going, why did they do that? They're doing that often either to stabilize sleep or to block those serotonin receptors on the dopamine neurons to disinhibit those dopamine neurons in the prefrontal cortex so you get better dopamine signaling. So there's strategies behind this. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. Now, why is it important? And by the way, Then you have the limbic system. Limbic system is where you get your aggression, your rage, your hostility, your hallucinations and delusions. Blocking dopamine here calms people and treats psychotic symptoms, hallucinations, delusions, and so forth. Now, I want you to think of disorders where there's an imbalance of prefrontal cortex and limbic system functioning. Prefrontal cortex is knocked down for some reason. The limbic system's still functioning like it should. And just so you have a little more clarity on what I mean, if you're on your way home tonight, somebody cuts you off on the interstate, and you get that initial urge to send them a hand signal, which I know at Southern Adventist University you never send, but you know that aggressive urge, okay? That aggressive urge is coming out of your limbic system. But when you remember, hold on, wait a minute, I am a student, so I wouldn't behave like that. Then you restrain yourself. That's your prefrontal cortex. So think of disorders in which prefrontal cortex is now impaired. Oh, let's take attention deficit disorder. Attention deficit disorder, due to dopamine signaling problems in prefrontal cortex, the limbic system is still firing normal. And what is the core feature of attention deficit disorder? But impulse control problems. They can't restrain themselves. They act out. They have all the impulses they can't hold back. Let's take a different disorder, Alzheimer's dementia. Loss of neurons in the prefrontal cortex and acetylcholine signaling problems. We have a different problem with the prefrontal cortex being impaired in a different way. And as people demand, what do they have? But impulse control problems. They act out in all types of sexual and aggressive ways, shouting things they shouldn't shout, saying things they shouldn't say. What about alcohol intoxication? Intoxicate somebody with alcohol. You knock down the prefrontal cortex. The limbic system's still working. Everybody knows when people get intoxicated, they get disinhibited, right? And they start saying and acting out and doing things like they shouldn't do. Just ask Mel Gibson recently, right? Yes, yes.
What about Tourette's?
Tourette's syndrome is a disorder of dopamine signaling in the striatal neurons where you have movement in the striatal neurons here, not prefrontal cortex neurons. Okay, that's a good question. And a different disorder. What about television watching in children? Television watching in children. I shouldn't say disorder. Different syndrome. Okay. Television watching in children. You all seen the studies that television watching in children increases aggression, violence, murder rates in societies go up where television is permitted. If you don't have television in society, murder rates are significantly less, usually 100% less in societies without television than with television because of this phenomenon I'm about to show you. And attention deficit rates are higher in children who watch television than not television. Why? Well, I already told you earlier about the plasticity of the brain. You come into the life with 200 billion neurons, and then the brain starts chipping away, getting rid of the neurons that aren't being used. Now, what is theatrical? We're talking theatrical television. We're not talking that you're watching, you know, the sermon on a closed-circuit TV in an overflow room. Okay, we're talking theatrical television. Now, what happens during theatrical television? Are you using your prefrontal cortex? Prefrontal cortex is turned off, not using it. There's no reason, there's no engagement. It's not the same thing as reading a story to a child, because to read a story to the child, they have to use their prefrontal cortex to activate their imagination to create the scene. You don't do that with television. It's all turned off. Not only is it just not suspended, not only is it suspending the activity of the prefrontal cortex, all theatrical television is designed to activate your limbic system. So you have that seat of emotions, those feelings, whether it's a comedy to make you laugh, whether it's a drama to make you suspense, whether it's a scary movie to make you have fear and stimulate the amygdala, whether it is an erotic movie to get you aroused, it doesn't really matter. All programs are designed to get an emotional limbic system activation while suspense prefrontal cortex. Now, if you do that over time, especially during a developing brain where the neurons have not yet been established and it's deciding which ones to keep and which ones to lose, just like the child we talked about earlier, locking them away and don't speak language to them for 5 years, you lose all those neurons, now you have trouble. Kids who watch lots of theatrical television as youngsters lose neurons in the prefrontal cortex, and later in life they have difficulty for focusing, learning, and so forth. So, the American Academy of Pediatrics, American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry recommend zero TV for the first 2 years of life. Zero. Zero, zero, zero. And then very strict limits thereafter. My recommendation is zero TV for the first 7 years of life. Okay? Because that brain doesn't need all that stimulation in this unhealthy way. And then one more syndrome, childhood abuse. Abuse a child physically or sexually. And I want you to think about this experience. I want you to put yourself, imagine yourself in a scenario where at any moment somebody could come through the door and beat you or rape you. That could happen at any moment. That's the reality that you're in right now. And in that reality, you have to take your board examinations. How would you do? Horrible, right? And you have a developed brain. Now think about these kids whose brains aren't developed and live in a home where daddy beats them or daddy molests them. At any time, Daddy could come in and do this, so they have this constant amygdala limbic system activation, stimulation with all this anxiety, which impairs functioning of the prefrontal cortex, so the prefrontal cortex is not working, and so they end up growing up not only with bad modeling, not only with bad psychodynamics, not only with bad object relations and relational dynamics, but they grow up with bad hardware, where the limbic system is overactivated, and the prefrontal cortex is not developed properly, and so these people grow up with what? They grow up with impulse control problems, acting out in all kinds of ways, and they're irrational, illogical, unreasonable people that can't really be talked to, and they have a distorted reality of life. Anybody know patients like this?
Mm-hmm.
Or people like this? Okay? These people are to be pitied. This is why Christ said, woe to those who abuse the kids. They better have a millstone, because you're damaging everything. Software and hardware, everything's being damaged. I tell you all this because whenever you have impairments of prefrontal cortex and you don't knock down limbic system to keep the balance, you're going to end up with aggression, impulse control problems of various kinds. Okay. So review of the pathophysiology, impaired brain metabolism, impaired neural signaling, impaired neurogenesis, which is the creation of new neurons, neuronal loss, losing the neurons are dying, this is all during depression, impaired electrical activity in the brain doesn't fire like it should, doesn't have electrical activity, EEGs will show differences, impaired protein production in the brain, altered gene expression in the brain, impaired prefrontal cortex activity in the brain. Do we see a physical problem going on here when people are depressed? This is a real brain illness, and we should be able to convince our patients this is an illness that needs to be treated. Okay, causes of depression. Risk factors / causes that are non-modifiable. These are non-modifiable. You got them, you got them. You can't do anything about them. Genetics. You got bad genes, you got bad genes. Everybody, every person in your family for the last five generations have had depression, you're in bad shape. Because you're going to have depression, you're going to be on medicine. Because you've got bad genes. The acorn does not fall far from the tree. Okay, so you've all noticed that, haven't you? Gender. You're a woman? You're a woman. Okay. What can I tell you? You're going to have a 1 out of 4 chance in lifetime risk of depression. Age. Adolescents have higher risk of depression, and elderly people have higher risk of depression. So adolescents, and whatever your age is. But it's modifiable in the one sense that once you pass your adolescence, your risk will drop from that risk slightly throughout the rest of your life. If you haven't had an episode through adolescence, had your episode through adolescence, then you have a history of previous depression, and that history raises your risk of further depressions. And then family history of depression. So your genetics, your gender, your age, whether you're adolescent or elderly, your history of previous depression, family history of depression, and history of trauma, that childhood abuse business we just talked about. If you've been raised in a home like that, your risk of depression are much higher than somebody who wasn't raised in a home like that. And you can't change that history. It was historical fact. We can do psychotherapies that can have significant impact on helping people resolve their issues, especially the software dynamic side of the trauma, but we can't undo the historical facts of the trauma.
The trauma thing, can it also be people that are very sensitive, perhaps, and so the parents maybe yelled at them at a higher level of decibels, but not really... what we would consider abuse, and then that person was very, very sensitive to that. Also be part of it?
That's a great point, and she's talking about perceptions now. Mm-hmm. That there are different levels of perceptions. There are actually been some disorders, very rare cases, of people who have a hypersensitivity to touch. And there's a case report of a lady who, as a child, a cotton shirt would feel like equivalent to you would be putting sandpaper on your skin and rubbing it up and down. This is how it would feel to this child. And so the child would never want to wear clothes. As a little girl, she would want to take her clothes off and run around without clothes. And her mother was constantly battling her to keep her clothes on. And she was called a problem child. She was called a moody child. She was called a temperamental child. She'd be spanked. She'd be forced to put this stuff on. And constantly back and forth. And she grew up with this inferiority because she was always a difficult child. She didn't, and sounds were more sensitive to her. Imagine taking, like, scraping nails on a chalkboard and putting it up the volume of a jet engine, okay? And just screeching horrible sounds. She would feel that way if you went to a mall, just the sounds of a mall, but she was so sensitive to sound and touch that she didn't want to go anywhere. She'd always run out of the mall. She'd rather stand in the rain than be in a mall because the noise was too much. She couldn't take it. And she grew up in this environment in which Nobody understood this, and so she was punished constantly by her parents, told she was a brat, told she was a bad kid, told she was just wanted everything her way, was not willing to get along with anybody, didn't want to compromise, didn't want to do anything. And as an adult, they discovered that she had this problem. And it wasn't that she had any of the moody, temperamental, bad attitude stuff that they were saying. It's that she felt like people were scraping her sandpaper, like people were blasting noise in her ears, and she was simply reacting because her perception was altered. So that's a great point. Somebody can have these problems and experience a sense of trauma and be traumatized simply because they have a perception problem. They perceive the world differently than everyone else. That's not very common, but it is something that you want to keep in the back of your mind. Yes?
Now, we talked about children being experienced trauma and they're in the building stages. What about your post-traumatic stress disorders, your people that are, your soldiers that are exposed to, I mean, what difference in the mechanisms?
Yeah, somebody who, remember the amygdala is the part of the brain that gives you a sense of anxiety and alertness, okay? Somebody goes into a combat environment, the amygdala, one of the theories going on with the PTSD patients is, imagine right now you're in a combat zone in Iraq, and you're a soldier, American in Iraq. How would you feel right now? Okay? And you hear a car drive by. Do you pay attention to that? Mm-hmm. You hear something slam, door slam in the other room. Do you pay attention to that? Okay? What is enabling you to pay attention to all these things? Is your amygdala is geared up and it's on alert. Okay? You're hypervigilant. And so what happens is the theory is that people are in combat situations for length of time is that the actual baseline set of your amygdala is permanently elevated. When you come back from that experience, the amygdala never goes back to its preset. And so you constantly have this hypervigilance. You startle more easily. You react more quickly because your amygdala is preset and it takes a lot less to get your amygdala fired now than it did prior. So that was an adaptation to a real life scenario in which you're under constant threat. So that's one of the theories going on behind what's going on with the PTSD in a combat veteran. Okay, so risk factors that are modifiable. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on all these. I'm going to spend a time on a few of them. But medical illnesses. Obviously, if you care for yourself better, you can avoid some of the medical illnesses. That's a modifiable risk. And, of course, if you treat some of these things more effectively, heart disease, cancers, diabetes, AIDS, and terminal illnesses all increase your risk for depression. Nutritional deficiencies, I'm going to get to specific nutritional issues in a moment because you'll want to know about those. Infections, HIV, tertiary syphilis, prions, which are your like mad cow disease and the Jakob-Creutzfeldt disease, the slow viruses, spongiform disorders of the brain that actually chew up your brain and you just lose neurons. And the Borna viruses, which are actually carried by horses and sometimes can cross into humans, and horses and cows and sometimes can cross into humans and cause depression. So toxins, mercury, arsenic, lead, and bismuth, which is in Pepto-Bismol, and if you have somebody who really, really binges on the Pepto-Bismol, that could be a factor for a depression. So you really want to watch if somebody's just using Pepto-Bismol, like somebody uses a pack of Tums and they're just popping that stuff all day, all day, all day, that could be a factor. Industrial solvents and chemicals, there's so many industrial solvents and chemicals. If somebody's exposed to those things, you might want to consider that possibility. Hormonal irregularities, modifiable thyroid, estrogen, progesterone. And, of course, later in life with men, you want to keep testosterone in the back of your mind. Testosterone deficiencies at late life can be a factor of depression, and supplementing testosterone with testosterone gels can be very helpful. Unremitting stress, real or imagined, doesn't really matter because the brain will react the same and the body will react the same, kicking out all the corticosteroids, which will shut down brain drive neurotrophic factor, which will result in loss of neurons and hippocampal regions and depression. So real or imagined unremitting stress is a risk factor that is modifiable. Brain injury or damage. Brain diseases, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, Pick's disease, Lewy body dementia, any of the brain diseases can lead to depression, losing neurons, lead to depression. Unhealthy relationships, and we aren't going into those tonight, I just don't have the time to do that. Unless somebody has a specific question, but we can have a whole discussion on relational dynamics and how unhealthy relationships end up resulting in depression and how healthy boundaries and healthy relational dynamics can avoid that. For further modifiable ones, unresolved guilt, appropriate or inappropriate guilt, and I have a whole lecture on that, on guilt resolution issues. So if we don't resolve the guilt properly, it can lead to depression. Sleep disorders,
chronic sleep disorders, depression, circadian rhythm problems. Limited physical activity, don't get your exercise. By the way, regular aerobic exercise causes the body to produce brain-derived neurotrophic factor. So if you exercise regularly, keep the neurotrophic factors going, keep your brain healthy, learn faster, easier, and better. Alcohol and drugs, risk factors for depression. Bad stuff. Pregnancy, risk factor for depression. Do that. Northern Hemisphere, risk factor for seasonal affective disorder. When you live in the Northern Hemisphere, you don't get enough light. Some people are very susceptible to depression, seasonal affective disorder. Isolation, isolate somebody from society. Kids raised in homes in which they've been isolated by abusive parents, sometimes spouses who are isolated away by an abusive husband. Isolation can cause depression. Spiritual factors, holding grudges, resentment, bitterness, anger, inability to forgive, cause depression. Loss, grief, that is not worked through. It's not depression to have the sense of sadness, dysphoria, crying, and the loss that comes when we lose somebody close to us. That is not unhealthy, it's actually appropriate, but if it's not worked through, it can result in developing depression. And then medications. All those medications contribute to depression. Beta blockers, reserpine, we talked about benzodiazepines, barbiturates, anticonvulsants, calcium channel blockers, estrogens, norplant, statins, interferon, and you should remember interferon. I get referrals constantly from gastroenterologists who are starting hepatitis C patients on interferon because it's a major risk factor, big risk factor. More than half the patients that go on interferon have developed depression. So you definitely want to be very aware of the depression associated with interferon. And in fact, you would get a malpractice suit if you had a person with a history of depression and they get hepatitis C and you start them with interferon and don't have some plan in place to deal with their depression. Suicide is also very high in interferon patients when they get depression. So you need to be very aware of that. Accutane, be aware of that because Accutane is going to be prescribed most often to who? And adolescents have a higher risk of depression, so you need to be aware of that one. Narcotics and then the fluoroquinolones, antibiotics. All those are risk factors for depression. So, and because of that, if somebody has some of these risk factors, you may be able to make a change. And let's say somebody has a risk factor. They're depressed, and you check their thyroid, and the TSH is 300. So they're clearly hypothyroid. What would you want to do with that patient?
Treat their thyroid.
Okay. Treat their thyroid. Is that all?
Treat their depression in the meantime.
Exactly. You do not treat the thyroid first before you treat the depression. You treat them simultaneously. You start the thyroid medication, but you also treat the depression. You don't expect the thyroid treatment to treat the depression. Why? The thyroid's going to get the thyroid functioning again, but we've already gone through this whole cascade of events in the brain. They're depressed, right? Okay, we've got to get that brain going again. And the antidepressant or whatever intervention you want to use will work to help get their brain going. So you want to treat it. Same thing here. If you have somebody on a beta blocker, Inderol is a classic one, and they think that the beta blockers contribute to depression or interferon, you still want to treat that depression and then deal with the other switching of the medication. You still treat the depression.
What about the statins?
The statins, any of the statins can do it. And the statins are, and the reason for the statins probably is that cholesterol is an important fat in neuronal health. And if you don't have cholesterol, your body makes cholesterol because it's very important in very many functions in the brain and the body. Well, there's been some case reports of people on a statin drug having amnesia. Have you heard of that? Okay? Where they have serious amnesia. They've lost memory. They can't remember things. And it was a direct side effect of the cholesterol-lowering agent dropping cholesterol so low that the brain can't make memories anymore. And so, yeah, if some patients are real sensitive and cholesterols are too low, they can have various neurologic and psychiatric.
How low is too low?
Well, it depends on the individual's physiology and what their needs are. Everybody is a little different. So I can't give you a specific number, but yes.
Is that you just on a short course and it can cause depression?
You know, that's a good question. Most people, and I don't know the answer to that question, honestly, whether it's just a short course or not. I wouldn't expect short course like, 10-day course. Sometimes you're at UTI, you treat with one pill. That's it. I wouldn't expect that to be able to do that now. But somebody with a chronic infection that's one of these chronic labels probably talking about. Okay, but nutritional factors. Omega-3 fatty acids. Folate, vitamin B6, vitamin B12, homocysteine, and tryptophan. I'll just mention tryptophan right now. Tryptophan is a dietary amino acid, which is a precursor to serotonin. If you're tryptophan deficient in your diet, you're going to have increased risk of depression. Most people get plenty of tryptophan in the diet, so you really have to look at that. You have to actually work to avoid tryptophan in most diets. But it's something just to keep in the back of your mind. That's all we're going to say about tryptophan. We're going to talk a little more about the rest of them, okay? Omega-3 fatty acids first. Omega-3 fatty acids are an essential nutrient that your brain and body require, but they cannot make it. If you don't get it in the food you have, you don't have it. There's several good things for you, actually multiple really good things for you. Raises HDL cholesterol, which is a good cholesterol, lowers LDL cholesterol, protects against ischemic heart attacks and strokes. Great side effect, not why I give it as a psychiatrist. Why do I give it as a psychiatrist? There we go. Neuronal membrane. The neuronal membrane, if you understand what that is depicting, those are fats. Okay, lipids. The neuronal membrane is made out of lipids. It's supposed to be made out of a balance of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. If you don't get omega-3s in your diet, your neuron doesn't have it, so it uses omega-6. It uses omega-6, the neuronal membrane integrity is altered. It's more rigid and stiff, less elastic, less pliable, and neural signaling is impaired. Studies show that people that have low omega-3 fatty acids have higher rates of depression. There's a cross-national comparison of relationship between seafood consumption and lifetime prevalence rates of bipolar spectrum illness, published in Psychiatric News January 2004, showed Iceland, highest seafood consumption in the world, zero prevalence of bipolar illness. Korea, Taiwan, Puerto Rico, next lowest, next highest seafood consumption, you'll notice their bipolar prevalence rates are under 1%. Germany, Hungary, and Switzerland, lowest seafood consumption in the world, highest bipolar prevalence rates of 5 to 7% in these countries. The United States is in the middle in our seafood consumption, and we have about 3% bipolar prevalence rate in the United States. Postpartum depression. Before I tell you about postpartum, I'll tell you first about infants. Mother's milk is high in omega-3 fatty acids. Cow's milk has no omega-3 fatty acids. Study of children weaned on mother's milk compared to cow's milk followed them in adolescence. A 10 to 15 point higher IQ for the kids who are weaned on mother's milk with the omega-3s than children raised without the omega-3s. You want to give your kids omega-3 fatty acid supplements as they're growing up. It's good for their brain development. Now, the mother's breast will take the omega-3s, whatever she has, even if she's in the depleted state, and give to the child. And so, the omega-3 depletion is one of the factors that lead to postpartum depression. This is my theory for quite some time, and in fact, last year, University of Arizona did a study showing that omega-3 supplementation through the pregnancy and postpartum period reduces the rate of postpartum depression. So you want to put your mothers not only on their prenatal vitamin and their folic acid, you want to put them on omega-3 fatty acids because it's good for them, it's good for their baby, it's good for their postpartum period. Yes?
As well as the
mothers. Yes. Absolutely, you want that. Okay. This is a study on rats where they took rats, made them all diabetics, randomized them into two groups. One group got omega-3 fatty acids, the other group got safflower oil, followed them for 24 weeks and looked at their retinas to see if their retinas had any of the diabetic retinal damage. See those little black spots there? All the retinal damage that diabetics get? All of the rats with safflower oil had retinal damage. None of the rats on omega-3 fatty acids had any retinal damage. Okay? So, this is an animal study, but it's good data showing how omega-3, and they did not feel this was due to vascular protection. They felt that the omega-3s were conferring direct protection to the photosensitive cells from the toxic effects of the high glucose. Okay? So you want omega-3 fatty acids. These are good stuff. Questions about omega-3s. Side effect comes from fish oil. Can belch, fishy taste of taste. If you have somebody who's a strict vegetarian and they want to take a vegan type vegetarian and they want to take a plant source, they can use flaxseed. The difference between flaxseed and fish oil is that flaxseed omega-3s are shorter chain omega-3s than the long fish oil omega-3s. And that's because when you take flaxseed oil, your liver will have to conjugate that and lengthen the chains before your brain can use it as effectively. If you take the fish oil, the fish's liver has already conjugated a bunch of that for you, and you get the longer stuff, which is really good for your brain. So I tend to give my patients the fish oil, but if they refuse it, the flax oil is fine. Yes.
What dose do you recommend?
All of my patients go on 2,000 milligrams a day,
If they're treatment refractory, a dose has 4,000 milligrams a day. I don't go higher than 4,000 milligrams a day because high doses of omega-3 fatty acids have blood thinning effects, and you can increase the risk of hemorrhagic strokes. Now, there was a study done on bipolar patients at Harvard University where they were treated with 9,000 milligrams a day of omega-3 fatty acids, and all of the patients, it was a small study, but all the patients had mood stabilization with no medication at all, just with the omega-3s. But at 9,000 milligrams a day, you increase the risk of hemorrhagic stroke, and you smell like a fish. So it's hard to get people to take 9,000 milligrams a day. But it does have great mood stabilizing effects. There's other evidence that show it has neuroprotective effects, antioxidant effects, and reduced risk of developing Alzheimer's dementia later in life. There's study after study after study. Additionally, in adolescents, and juveniles who have been locked up for violent crimes, and adults actually, the omega-3 fatty acids with the multivitamin together have shown to reduce aggressiveness and violence in people with a history of aggressiveness and violence. So it's good stuff. Good stuff. Yeah, other questions about the omega-3s?
Do you use it as a preventative?
Yes. Oh, yes. I put all my patients. So everybody goes on omega-3s that I take omega-3s every day. I take 3,000 a day, every day. See? And I didn't forget anything yet.
You take a divided dose, or you just pop three?
I put three in the morning.
Okay.
Yeah, I take three in the morning.
Where do you get them from? Like, some people say you have to get them from...
If you want them over the counter, Walmart is good. Consumer Report did an assessment on various manufacturers looking at what they had and the concentrations, if they're in heavy metal contaminants and all that stuff. And Walmart was a good brand. It was cheap, and it was clean, and it was a good brand. If you want to be sure, if you're a little paranoid, oh, I don't know about that over-counter stuff, it's not bad, it might have a little heavy metal contaminant in it, then you can get a prescription brand called Omicor. Omicor, 4 a day, if you take 4 a day, will cost you $155 a month. But Omicor is pharmaceutical grade, and the difference is it's pharmaceutical grade, so you're sure that it's just the pure omega-3, number one. Number two, the over-the-counter brand has 160 milligrams of DHA and 140 milligrams of EPA in each 1,000 milligram gel capsule. You're getting 300 milligrams of what you need in each 1,000 milligrams of omega-3 you take. The Omicor brand has 850 milligrams of what you need in each 1,000 milligrams, so they concentrate the stuff more too. So you really have to take 2.5 of the over-the-counter for every one of the Omicor. So that's another reason why, too. Now, the only time you don't want to give omega-3s to somebody, and this is just a little pearl to put in the back of your brain, probably you'll never have to really use it, is somebody who's got active tuberculosis. Active tuberculosis, even when you put in the tuberculin medicines, the lysozymes cannot, the omega-3s impair lysozyme binding inside the phagosomes, and so the lysozymes can't bind to kill the tuberculin bacteria when they have omega-3 fatty acids. So if you have somebody with tuberculin infection, don't give them omega-3s, give them arachidonic acid, which is another fat, and arachidonic acid actually accelerates lysozyme binding, which will accelerate the clearing of the tuberculin infection. Other questions about omega-3s?
Do you worry about the source for your omega-3s as far as the United States versus outside the United States?
I use Omicor, so I don't worry. I use the pharmaceutical grade, so I used to use just the Walmart brand, or actually I never used Walmart brand. I used GNC, and I used Vitamin World and some of those others until the Omicor came out, and then I switched to Omicor, and I just used the Omicor, so. Okay, anything else on the omega-3s? Okay, folate, B6, B12, and the homocysteine connection. Have you all heard of homocysteine? Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to walk through homocysteine. The thiamine is an amino acid that you get in dietary protein. Methionine is metabolized within ATP to become S-adenosyl methionine, also known as SAM. This is your main methyl donor in various multiple processes, intracellular processes throughout the body, DNA, myelination, catecholamine synthesis, phospholipids, proteins. SAM is your methyl donor for many of these processes. After SAM gives up its methyl group, it goes to S-adenyl homocysteine, which then ends up going to homocysteine. Homocysteine is an amino acid, which is not a necessary one, but it's a byproduct of the methionine metabolism. Homocysteine, I want you to imagine dragging some barbed wire through a soft rubber hose. What do you think would happen if you drug some barbed wire through a soft rubber hose?
Shreds.
Okay, that's what homocysteine does to your endothelial lining throughout your body. Homocysteine nicks and tears the endothelial lining throughout the endothelium is inside the various arteries and arterioles. Okay, and it nicks and tears them as it runs through the body. Thus, it increases the risk of microvascular injury, so you can get increased risk of heart disease, sudden heart death, and microvascular stroke, so the vascular dementias, and neuronal loss and their neurotoxic, homocysteine is also neurotoxic, increasing oxidative stress. Oxidative stress results in more neuronal loss, okay? So the homocysteine is not friendly. We don't want homocysteine in our body. Now, you'll notice that homocysteine is gotten rid of in two pathways. One pathway, you'll notice there, is vitamin B. Vitamin B is essential for this pathway to metabolize homocysteine. This pathway uses vitamin B12 and the folates. And if you're deficient in either B12 or vitamin B or the folates, then you can't metabolize homocysteine. Homocysteine levels rise. Homocysteine levels rise. They result in damage to neurons and damage to the vasculature. It's not what you want. So we want good folates. We want good vitamin B12 and B6. Everybody see that? Okay. Now, problems with elevated homocysteine. Oxidative injury, impaired methylation throughout the body, impaired DNA synthesis and repair, cytotoxic effects via the NMDA, glutamate subreceptors, increasing calcium inflow, which causes oxidative stress and neuronal loss and so forth and so on, and the potential impact of inflammatory pathways also. Inflammation may be increased by elevated homocysteine levels. And this is just kind of showing you that neuronal loss can happen from beta amyloid. Beta amyloid causes the elevation of glutamate. Glutamate stimulates the NMDA receptor. Homocysteine is also stimulating the NMDA receptor. Calcium influx is flowing inside the cell. When more calcium flows inside the neurons, higher than normal amounts level, it causes the oxidative stress, free radical formation, and cell death. The neurons start dying. And this is one of the functions going on with the amyloid in Alzheimer's dementia. And then you get the vascular injury over here as well. So homocysteine is toxic to the neurons as well as to the vasculature, bad stuff. Now, on this slide, everything on this slide except age and gender and pregnancy elevate homocysteine. Young women before menopause have lower homocysteine levels. After menopause, their homocysteine levels start rising. And pregnancy significantly lowers homocysteine levels during pregnancy. It's thought to be due to maybe a delusional factor. But everything else on here elevate homocysteine. But look at the things that elevate homocysteine and think about the consequence to a person's life. Smoking elevates homocysteine, and smoking shortens lifespan. Alcohol intake, high alcohol intake, coffee consumption, low physical activity, poor nutrition, stress, as well as various anti-epileptic drugs, various colon disorders, inflammatory diseases, malignancies, all these things result in elevated homocysteine levels. We don't want elevated homocysteine levels. And elevated homocysteine levels result in cardiovascular problems, neuropsychiatric problems, pregnancy complications, birth defects, and anemia. So we don't want elevated homocysteine. Okay, what about vegetarians and B12 levels? 78%, this was a study, 2000, 78% of vegans were low in the vitamin B12 in this particular study compared to 24% of lacto-vegetarians and 0% of omnivores in this particular study. What happened in the study, what happened to the homocysteine levels? And homocysteine levels, different study actually, 53% of vegans had elevated homocysteine levels, 29% of lacto-vegetarians had elevated homocysteine levels, and 5% of omnivores have elevated homocysteine levels. So homocysteine levels elevation is not good. Low homocysteine levels. If B12 in breast milk of 75%, that was a small study, only 8 vegan mothers, or vegetarian mothers, 75% of them, 6 out of 8 though, mothers had B12 levels, low B12 levels in the breast milk. Whereas 27%, 3 out of 11 in omnivores have low B12 levels in the breast milk. And then what happened to their infants' homocysteine levels? You'll see the vegan mother's homocysteine levels. These are the infants now. These are the homocysteine levels of infants who had vegan mothers. These are the homocysteine levels of infants who had omnivore mothers. You notice those homocysteine levels over here? Homocysteine levels are toxic to neurons. We don't want toxic neurons to our babies, do we? No. So we need to do something about these homocysteine levels. We need to have better B12 and B6 and folate levels. Okay, other factors involved in this. 30 to 40% of intrinsic B12 is destroyed with microwave cooking. Mm-hmm. How many people cook by microwave? Does anybody cook with anything other than microwave? Does anybody remember the days before microwave? I remember the days before microwave. I'm aging myself here, but yes. Okay, 50% of natural folates are destroyed by conventional cooking, and higher than 50% is destroyed by microwave cooking. Cooking your food destroys folates. B12 requires low pH for absorption. The PPIs, what's a PPI? Name one. Prevacid, Prilosec, Nexium. They raise pH, lower the acid, raise the pH, and they inhibit the absorption of B12. One study shows that within 2 weeks, Depending on the dose of the PPI given, it was either 71 or 88% reduction in B12 absorption in 2 weeks on the PPI.
Lots of people
are. Everybody's on PPIs. And the only saving grace is that B12s take a long time to deplete in the body. But in your practice, these PPIs have been out now for what? What's the first PPI? Was it Prevacid? No, it was Prevacid. Which one's the first? Prevacid is out 10 years now, 11, 12? You're going to start seeing now, after a decade of these things being available, lots of problems with patients with elevated homocysteine levels because of low B12 levels. You're going to see anemias, you're going to see increasing vascular injuries, you're going to see heart disease, you're going to see all kinds of things going up unless you're checking your patient's homocysteines and supplementing them on these disorders.
What about H2 blockers? You have a...
H2 blockers can do it as well. If they raise the pH of the GI system, H2 blockers can do it as well.
PPIs are more effective.
PPIs are way more effective. Yeah. Okay, and then hormone replacement therapy decreases homocysteine levels. So postpartum period, putting woman on hormone replacement therapy lowers the homocysteine levels. This is depressed patients versus controls. Homocysteine levels are elevated in 20% of the depressed patients. Essentially none of the controls had elevated homocysteine levels. B12 folate, homocysteine, and depression. Low folate is more common in depressed patients than controls. Depressed patients with low folate level have poor outcomes. They don't respond as well to treatment. Responders to imipramine and tricyclic antidepressant had higher folate levels than the non-responders. And 96 patients with depression and dementia with normal folate levels, check the folate levels first, which were given supplemental folate, to be found as effective in treating the depression as trazodone.
How much should you take?
Why would it be effective if they get normal folate levels? Does anybody want to know the answer to that question? Because neuronal folate and CNS folate levels are not a direct correlate to serum levels. You can have normal serum levels and still be low in the CNS. Okay, 127 patients with depression received 0.5 milligram of folate or a placebo added to Prozac 20 milligrams a day. The women, but not the men, showed a reduced homocysteine, and 93% of the women receiving the folate responded to Prozac versus 61% of placebo responding to Prozac. So they all had Prozac, some got folate, some got placebo. 93% of the ones with the folate added to Prozac responded. What's the response? 50% reduction in their symptoms, whereas only 61% of those just getting the Prozac alone had a 50% reduction. Preventative measures. Now, why did I put almonds up there? Anybody know why? Besides Linda. Pardon? Haven't heard it yet. Vitamin E. Vitamin E. Now, do you want to give your patients vitamin E supplements?
No.
Yes or no?
No.
No.
Teachers can't respond. No. Why do you not want to give vitamin E supplements? Okay, then if I don't want to give supplements, why do I want to give almonds that are high in vitamin E? Vitamin E comes in 6 isomeric forms in nature. The supplements have one of the 6 isomers. You know what an isomer is? Okay? One of 6 isomers of supplements. If you get just one of the 6, it actually throws an imbalance, and it actually is worse for you than not having any vitamin E supplementation. It actually increases risk of cardiovascular problems if you give vitamin E supplements. So don't give vitamin E supplements. However, almonds come from nature. They get all 6 isomeric forms. And so eating almonds actually shows, when you have diets high in vitamin E from natural sources, you actually have neural protection. It's an antioxidant that reduces oxidative stress on the neurons, which prevents neuronal loss. That's good. We want our neurons, don't we? Yeah. So we want almonds. I give almonds to how many of my patients eat raw? These are raw almonds. I don't know about the candy-coated roasted ones. I don't know. I don't know what happened to vitamin E.
What about black walnuts?
Black walnuts are high in omega-3 fatty acids.
Do you not have the vitamin E in them as well?
They very well may, but I don't like them. They're the moldy tasting ones.
What about the plain
walnuts? Don't have omega-3 in them.
Vitamin E?
They may have vitamin E, but almonds are the highest. Almonds are the highest.
I think the almonds are second.
Yeah. Omega-3 fatty acid supplementation. So these are things you want to do. Things you can do naturally to help prevent depression. Almonds?
That's not a whole can of almonds.
No, it's like 5 raw almonds a day. 5 raw almonds a day. Not a whole can. Vitamin C. Why do you want vitamin C? See, vitamin E, yeah, it's an antioxidant, right. Now, what's the difference between vitamin C and vitamin E?
That's water-soluble.
Say that again? Yeah, one's? Okay, so one's hydrophilic and one's lipophilic. Okay, which is the lipophilic?
Vitamin E.
Vitamin E, okay. Now, think about your neuron. Your neuron has, which part of it is fatty? The membrane. Vitamin E has antioxidant effects in the membrane, protecting things coming into the neuron. Which part's water soluble? What water? Cytoplasm. Vitamin C works in the cytoplasm to exert its antioxidant effects. So you get vitamin C, you get vitamin E, you got antioxidant effects in both places. And studies show that vitamin E and vitamin C supplementation, if you're getting the almond vitamin E, that is, actually reduce the risk of developing dementia later in life. Yes?
How much is the vitamin C?
It doesn't really matter because it's a water soluble, you just, out it goes.
Is there a minimal amount?
500,000, it doesn't really matter. Folates and B vitamins, we've already talked about the reasons for those. You want to supplement those. I personally put my patients on a drug called serifolin. You heard of serifolin? Mm-hmm. Serifolin, the reason for that is, I think it's, 40% of patients with dementia are poor metabolizers of folic acid. In order for folic acid to go into the brain, it has to be metabolized in the liver, and it's metafolin and actually gets through the blood-brain barrier and goes into the brain, not the straight folic acid. And so 40% of people with dementia don't metabolize folic acid well, and so they don't absorb straight folic acid into the brain. The serifolin has metafolin, 5 milligrams of metafolin. 5 milligrams of metafolin. Yes. Plus B6, B12, and B2 all together. I take a serifolin every day and omega-3 fatty acids every day.
Jim, the downside of that is when I've ordered that for my patients, they come back and say, it costs me $40 a month.
What I would say is, I like it, it's good. If they can't afford it, then ask their pharmacist to find out from your local pharmacy what generic folic acid, B vitamin complex they have available that you can get. It's better than to give them nothing. I mean, to give them that than to give them nothing. So that's fine. I put them in a generic if they can't afford it. If their insurance pays, they can afford it, then.
The B6, does it need to be 100, 200?
Yeah, what is the B6 in serifolin? I can't remember.
I think it is 100.
It's over 100, I think.
200.
It's 100 to 200, yeah.
How do you spell that? Serifolin.
C-E-R-E. C-E-R-E-F-O-L-I-N.
What is the connection of white matter changing changes with dementia? What is the connection there?
Yeah, I guess it depends on your dementia.
Most of your elderly patients, when they have dementia, you notice that it's usually mild to moderate.
With the white matter? Mm-hmm. Well, obviously the dementia is primarily due to the neuronal loss. And as people progress in, say, an Alzheimer's dementia, one of the arguments to use, say, a drug like Exelon versus, say, the others, is that acetylcholine is broken down by an enzyme called...
Acetylcholinesterase.
Thank you! Acetylcholinesterase from the neurons. But the white matter produces another enzyme called butyrylcholinesterase. And so the thought is, as they get into the severe late stages of dementia, they've lost so many neurons, that most of the acetylcholine at that late stage is being broken down by butyrylcholinesterase from the white matter. And so Exelon blocks both acetylcholinesterase and butyrylcholinesterase. And some people theorize, and some doctors will actually tell you, that they can see improvement in later stages of dementia on Exelon versus a Razadine or Aricept. My personal experience is I can't tell a big difference. It's a theoretical argument. I can't tell a big difference. Yeah.
Do you ever address, like, a couple slides back, why homocysteine levels are elevated in vegetarians?
Yeah, because they have low vitamin B12.
Okay, so if they have adequate B12, then it's not.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You want to take the supplements of B12, B6, and folic acid. Yeah.
What about over-the-counter supplements?
You can do those as long as you take high enough. They're very low. They're very low milligrams. You have to take many more pills. It's much more efficient on your dollar if you have to get a generic prescription. 1 milligram folic acid prescription a month, if it's not the serifolin, will cost, I think it's like $5 or something. It's really cheap.
Yeah. Your serifolin has got your...
Turn the air down in here.
The B6 and the folate, but what about your B12? I mean, does it have to be sublingual or
intramuscular? Serifolin does have the B12, and if you have somebody with the PPI, then it's going to interfere with the absorption of it. So yeah, that's a complicating factor. Serifolin has the B12 in it, and it will be absorbed. And it doesn't have to necessarily be sublingual, but it will be absorbed, unless they have a GI pH problem. B12 is absorbed in the
duodenum, I believe, with a low pH coming through the gut. But if it doesn't have that low pH, then it won't be absorbed. So, okay. Exercise. Exercise is another preventative measure because it increases vascular development in the brain and also produces the good proteins in the brain. Yes.
I'm wondering how that compares to Metanex.
I don't know. I'm not familiar with Metanex.
It's about the same.
It's about the equivalent.
Healthy spirituality. Why healthy spirituality? What does that do for your brain?
It reduces stress.
Say that.
Stress.
Yes, it reduces stress. There's no question about it. A merry heart doeth good like a medicine. And it's true. The brain is wired into everything. And there's I don't have time to go in and tell you what we're discovering about how the brain impacts the physical health of the body. Okay. Avoid alcohol, drugs, tobacco, and caffeine. Regular sleep. Essential because during sleep there's rejuvenating processes that occur, restorative processes that occur, certain critical hormones are released in regular sleep that help you manage your stress, and so regular sleep is critical. Sunshine, of course, because of the vitamin D properties and also because of the seasonal affective disorder issues, and so you've got to get reasonable amounts of sunshine. If somebody is in a northern hemisphere process and they have a seasonal affective disorder, then a 10,000 lux light at 30 minutes a day before sunrise. If you give them the 10,000 lux light after sunrise, it will not work. It has to be before sunrise. The reason for that is you have to have it while you still have melatonin in the brain from the night before. And the melatonin will be lost after dawn, and it won't work. So the light reacts through the retinas, impacting the melatonin, which retreats the seasonal affective disorder. Without the melatonin, it doesn't work. So you need to give around 6 a.m. and sit in front of that light. They don't have to stare at the light. They just have the light close to them, and they can read their paper or whatever they're doing, read a book or whatever, but the light has to be within like a few feet of them, 10,000 lux for 30 minutes or more.
If you're a night shift worker.
Yeah, if you're a night shift worker, then you would do it.
You're all screwed up.
Yeah, night shift workers have higher rates of depression and physical problems and heart disease and diet, well, higher rates. Night shift workers, you just die. You know, you're just hosed. Okay. Treatment options and strategies, because we've got to move on because we haven't even got to our cases yet. Okay, treatment strategies, first, the treatment options. The first thing you want to do is you want to address the specific contributing factors. Somebody's got hypothyroidism, you want to be sure you identify it, and you want to deal with their hypothyroidism. Somebody has a nutritional deficit, you want to identify it, you want to deal with it. So, treatment option is, first, identify any contributing factors and deal with that. Second, you have all the antidepressants. We're not going to go through those again, but you have all the various antidepressants. Third, you have ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. It's an option. It's an option generally for people who don't want to take a medication. However, sometimes it's the first option. I've had patients who had a very severe psychotic depression, and it's great for psychotic depressions, and it was 2 weeks before Christmas, and they didn't want to be in a hospital over Christmas, and they wanted to have all their family. We hit them with ECT, and they're better by the end of the week. So ECT is really great, but some people want it. But you've got to persist with it, and the whole complications associated. You go under anesthesia and all of this stuff. Transcranial magnetic stimulation. It's going to be up and coming. You're going to hear a lot more about it in the near future. It's just now getting up and running. But basically, you go to a doctor's office, you sit down in a chair, they put a big electric magnet over your head, right over your hair, and it goes, and it has a funny feeling, kind of like the feeling you get if you've ever stuck your finger in a light bulb. Kind of, it's a little electrical kind of feeling, but it's not dangerous. And you can feel that right on your head, and you get that treatment for about 6-8 minutes. And then you go home, you come back, and you get that 5 times a week for 6 or 8 minutes, and it treats your depression. Then you get the VNS, which is vagal nerve stimulation, which is like a pacemaker. It's actually a surgical procedure where they insert a little device that provides electrical current to the vagal nerve, and the neurosurgeon ties it into your vagus nerve, stimulates the vagus nerve, and it treats chronic, severe, refractory, unremitting depressions. And most serious and most invasive and most hard to get would be deep brain stimulation, in which they actually open your skull and they slide a electrode down into the deep parts of your brain, and then they provide electrical current to your brain while you're awake, because they do the surgery while you're awake. They lock you in, and you're wide awake, and they're in there playing in your brain, and they'll turn this thing on, and they keep probing until they find the place where you go, I feel better now. And then they put that thing in, they put a pacemaker in your chest, they adjust it with a magnet, and they can turn the electrical current that they're adding artificially to your brain up or down and treat depression. And then psychotherapies, which are individual, group, cognitive, behavioral, dialectical, psychodynamic, lots of different psychotherapies. All of these things are part of your treatment options. I want you to hopefully you've written all those down, because you're going to need to select
as we go through our patients now, and you're going to form a treatment option, you're going to need to select a treatment. You're going to need to select a treatment plan, okay? And you're going to need to pick, what option do I want to use for this patient? And I didn't put on here, and I should have put on here, but I mentioned it just a moment ago, your 10,000 lux light is also a treatment option for the acetylcholine disorder. Okay. So treatment strategies now, you want to diagnose first. Always be sure your diagnosis is right. If your diagnosis is wrong, then most of the time your treatment's going to be wrong. So be sure you get your diagnosis right. After you get your diagnosis, assess the modifiable factors that they have going on. Remember all those modifiable factors? They have, oh, they're on Inderol. Oh, they got this problem. Oh, they got that problem. But let's assess those modifiable factors and modify those factors. Assess unique symptom profile. This is critical. Somebody with depression, one person may be sleeping 20 hours a day, another person is sleeping 2 hours a day. That would be a big difference in which agent you select. You want an agent for the 20-hour sleeper that's going to be activating. You want one with the 2-hour sleeper is going to be sedating at bedtime to help them sleep. So you're going to choose a different antidepressant depending on the side effect profile for the unique symptom cluster of that patient. So you want to be able to assess the unique symptom profile. Third or fourth, assess comorbid conditions. They have comorbid conditions contributing to this, like the hypothyroid condition, comorbid. You want to treat that in conjunction with the depression. Assess other medications, not just for the potential Vinderol causing worsening depression, but also for potential medication-medication interactions, that you don't put them on something that's causing an interaction with another medication already on. Consider previous treatments. That's a great one. Have you ever been treated with anything before? Did it work? Yeah, this stuff works like gold for me. Okay, that's the thing you have to start with. If they have a history and it works well for them, start with that one. You can also ask about the family history. Anybody in your family with depression? Yeah, my mother, my sister, my uncle. What do they take? Well, they're all on Effexor. They're doing great. Put them on Effexor. Okay, they've got a gene profile that Effexor works in that family. So start with that drug. Develop a formulation with specific contributing factors. So once you identify their depression, you should then formulate in your mind all the different things we just went over, formulating all the different contributing factors, because that will lead you directly to the next thing, which is your treatment plan to address all the different factors you have in your formulation.
Easy.
Yes.
In that 10 minutes that you have with them.
Right. We all this in 10 minutes.
Okay. Once you get some experience, actually, you can. You really can.
Okay. I've got a patient particularly who is a nurse, works nights, loves working nights in ICU. But her depression is absolutely astounding. And I've shared with her that I think that if she went to her studies, that it might be a lot more helpful for her, even though she's on a high dosage of serotonin. I think it's around Lexicon is what I put her on, but I mean, probably put her on some more Remlock protection too.
Mm-hmm. How's she sleeping during the day?
Not good. I mean, even with Ambien on board, not good. She's got some low self-esteem issues.
Are there other dynamic factors? What are the other forms
low self-esteem, she's got some abusive stuff going on. She's a single girl, wants a relationship, but just can't
She needs psychotherapy. I'm gonna
I know she does, and she's getting that.
Okay, good. Okay, so you've got her on the omega-3s.
Yeah.
Got her on a new good vitamin. Good.
But I just wonder, I mean, I mean, I've been dealing with her for about a year and a half, and she has been... She's also been a traveling nurse, so she's also gone for 3 to 6 months, like to Seattle one time, to Colorado another time. Always worth nights.
Alaska recently?
No. Just, you know, again, there's that isolation, you know, where she doesn't have any friends.
And her schedule
anyway.
Yeah, her schedule's always messed up.
But she's also very honest kind of one of her patients.
You know her?
I don't know.
Well... I mean, does she? I mean,
not really, no.
No, I don't think so. She does a lot of crying. A lot of crying.
And what other agents has she been on in the past?
Triazolam. She's tried the Wellbutrin. That doesn't give you nothing.
No. Has she been on Effexor?
Yeah.
And what drugs?
At 150.
Not high enough.
225.
You can go higher. 25, 300, easy. I'll get some patients on full kit.
What about the sweating with that? That's what I get.
Some patients will have sweating. I get probably less than 3% of my patients have sweating.
Okay.
Yeah. So you'll get some of that. You might just wish. Unfortunately, I think that's the only thing working.
But don't you think I really ought to stress getting on daytime schedule with her?
And if you don't, see, the thing is you have to get a sleep-wake schedule going. What I see with third shift workers, it's not just that they work third, it's that they constantly are swinging.
So on
the weekends, you try not to stay up during the day and sleep at night, and on the weekends, you're supposed to be swinging around. So if you can't get her off thirds, then you ought to demand that she give a trial at least saying, on that same shift through the weekend, and then I would have stabilized that shift with for vigil during her wake time. And then do something to make get better sleep at bedtime. If the Ambien isn't working, then you may consider an augmentation of Seroquel. Seroquel 25 milligrams at bedtime, titrate by 25 every night until she sleeps soundly to refresh without sedation. She'd go up to 600 if she has to, she shouldn't have to. But if she's got a lot of borderline dynamics, she may have to. And the nice thing about Seroquel, which I didn't really get into, is Seroquel also has the ability to calm the limbic system for people who are limbic reactive. Okay, that limbic aggressive, but limbic impulsive, but limbic, all that stuff, anxiety, and it disinhibits the prefrontal cortex dopamine secreting neurons. So you activate prefrontal cortex and calm the limbic system. So people who have that overreactive limbic system, Seroquel is a good adjunct agent for them because it helps calm the limbic system, restore that balance. They think better, feel better, and less of that stuff to be modulating all the time. It's very good calming for them. So you may try that as an adjunct agent. Yeah.
Different note. How many of your patients you put on
Remeron
have the
pulmonary edema? Actually, I see that occasionally. That does happen occasionally. I have to say, probably no more than 1%.
Really?
Yeah, I do see that occasionally. Not necessarily pulmonary edema, but more
extremity
edema. Yeah, about 1%. Yeah, well, the weight gain you're going to expect if they're eating a lot. And so many times I put them on it because I've got sick patients, renal failure patients, nursing home patients, cancer patients with chemotherapy. I want to make them eat, so I often look for that and apply for that. But yeah, there are the occasional patients that get the swelling. Other questions? Well, thank you all very much.
Thank you.